Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch here on your number one talk radio station, Eagle FM. Today is the 10th of the second month, 2026. It is a Tuesday evening and it's 3 minutes past the hour of nine. So now, vele, guys, like, Angie's going through a lot. Oh, my Matriarch is going through a lot and there. So today my intention was, right? My intention was to show up at work and, you know, to just come try my best and then come do my thing and feel better. And then just when I got, like, just before I got here, I was like, nah, I can't do this. You know, my heart's not feeling good. I'm out. And that has been happening a lot with me lately. It has been happening a lot. And I was now, I thought it was maybe part of like, which is, it is part of MDD. So it's part of it. But I wanted to specifically know, like, what is it exactly that takes away all the joy? You know, when somebody finds, comfort in certain things and finds joy in certain things, and then I'm so sorry about that, and find joys in certain things, and then all of a sudden these things are no longer exciting, no longer meaningful, nothing gives you pride, nothing gives you joy, nothing gives you any kind of emotion at all. It's just like a flat line, you know, and this flat line is like a numbness, but it's not a numbness because you still feel pain and you still feel agony and you still feel sorrow and you still feel frustrated and you still feel everything else, right? So what is it? This dopamine hit that my soul is searching for, right? It's something that I'm not getting. This fulfillment that my soul is not getting is something that I'm struggling to find.
My friend, why do you seem so worried?
Ace, I'm planning an event for next weekend, eh? And I don't know how to best get people to hear about it.
Saima, don't worry about those small things. Contact Eagle FM today. Eagle FM has a dedicated team that can travel anywhere countrywide to broadcast live at any event, such as a promotion, organizational launch, anniversary, wedding, funeral, political or traditional and church events, and basically any event that you wish to broadcast on a national level. Call them now and talk to Monica at 081-270-3727 or the office number 083-288-400. Eagle FM, the I.
Alrighty, welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We're doing a Midnight Express here on Pulling Heartstrings, where I'm just going to be talking. I'm going to be airing my dirty laundry and I'm going to be letting my little heart furuka out. And I'm hoping somebody's going to catch me out there. And if you can't catch me, you might as well listen. So, So as we all know, right? I'm not feeling well. As we all know, diagnosis, I'm not feeling well. So I have MDD, right? And a gang of other little stuff as well that they also complement and contribute to the disease. Should we call it? Yeah, the ailment, right? That's why I say that when we talk about mental health, we must not be like, mental health. Mental health is like saying illness, right? And every illness has its own name. And every illness has its own. It's not like one umbrella that we must just be checking our mental health and checking in. It's like you going for saying that you must check your physical body. You must go for body checkups. It's basically the same. But then when it comes to mental health issues, it is more about, it's like this umbrella that people put up, like, mental health. Yes, the mental health of the mental health, right? So as we all know, I have MDD, which is major depressive disorder. And that means I am depressed, guys. Like, with all this laughing and all this jolly, I am depressed. I am exactly what a depressed person looks like. That's me. And part of what I have, so I am on medication, but what I have been experiencing lately is this state of not finding joy in anything. And even when I do find joy in something, it's short-lived. It's like it's like a little spark, but it just sparks a little bit and then it dies. It's like, oof. So right now, all I want to do in my life right now is just, I just want to sleep. I just want to sleep the day away and sleep the night away and sleep the day away and sleep the night away. And I just want to be in bed. I just want to do nothing. I just want to exist. I don't want to eat. I don't want to talk. I don't want to do nothing. I don't want to pass. I don't want to do nothing. I want to do nothing to me. I want to do nothing. And this, it is alarming, right? But it's part of the ailment, you know, it's part of the symptoms. It's part of what comes with it, you know? So you can't really say that, oh yeah, I am depressed. And there's also circumstantial depression, right? Like, you are depressed because of finances, or you are depressed because of lack of finances, or you are depressed because you're being violated, or you are depressed because of this, or you are depressed because of that. And that's, for me, that's circumstantial depression, where if we fix it that is wrong in your life, then you will no longer be depressed, right? But for me, it's something else. It's just, there's no real cause to it. It's just being overwhelmed by me and being overwhelmed by my life, being overwhelmed by who and what I am as a human being. And, you know, I was pushing and I was trying and I was going, you know, I keep going, you know how I am. I'm resilient and I'm strong and I'm courageous and I'm brave and I'm pushing for better days. So as I'm pushing for better days, in this push for better days, sometimes are good. Some days are good and some days are bad, and some days are in the middle and some days are just catastrophic. And I feel like I'm having more catastrophic days than I'm having good days. You know, I feel like the day doesn't have enough sunlight and doesn't have enough hours, because I blink and the day is over. And I blink and then the day has started, and I blink and then the day is over and it started. And it's a cycle. And I'm somewhat just in limbo, you know. And also part of the issues that I have is that I don't want to depress my kids. I don't want to depress my kids, and I don't want to put them in an environment where I'm crawling out of bed, you know. I'm crawling out of bed and I'm just trying to make it to the toilet. Just trying to make it to the toilet, and I'm just trying, you know. So I've shipped the children off to my mother. And Umsane also, like, shipped everybody off, and I'm in isolation. And I think the isolation also, it's getting to me a little bit more. But also in the isolation, I'm finding a little bit of peace. I think because I don't have to explain myself to anybody. I don't have to explain why I'm not putting on my wig. I don't have to explain why I'm getting up so early. I don't have to explain my night terrors and my sweat. And I don't have to explain, and I don't actually have to tell anybody how I feel. But I feel like the children are getting on. I feel like the children are catching up to it. And now they are concerned citizens that call every day. I just want to say how you are. And it's almost time for them to come home, because they don't live at their grandmother. And I don't know. I'm trying to figure out, like, in which state I am. And of course, you that might be listening and you are like a healthcare practitioner and you're like, oh, no, you must go to the doctor. Don't you worry about that. I have a follow-up tomorrow, so I will be there. I'll be at the doctor tomorrow. But I don't know if I'm getting worse or getting better. I am on medication. And the only side effects that I have seen so far with the medication has been diarrhea and complete loss of appetite. So I've lost a couple of kgs in the 2 months, you know, just a little bit, enough to make my uniform shake. We are shaker, Sunny. We are shaker. You know, and enough to make my jeans look like, what do they call them? Boyfriend jeans. So 90% of my jeans look like boyfriend jeans now. And, you know, when it comes to weight stuff, especially for girls that have, difficulties with body sizes and all of that, you know, you're comfortable in each and every era of your body, but it's not every day that you're actually fully, fully comfortable in it. Sometimes you just want to wear something and it doesn't fit. So with the medication, and the sudden weight loss to some degree, it has also toned me down, right? And when it toned me down, now I'm in my jeans, but my jeans don't look like they belong to me. They look more like boyfriend jeans. So all my jeans are all of a sudden boyfriend jeans now. And it is what it is. And my mood is just flat. And it feels empty. And the motivation, So now there is the functioning depression. The functional depressive person, and then there's the non-functional. The non-functional one is the one that we all don't want, where you're not getting anything right because you just can't, you know, you just can't. And then you find the functional ones, or they look like they are functioning or high functioning. They look like it because they go to work every day and they show up and they do what they need to do, and brilliance comes from them and. But it still does not mask necessarily what is in your heart. It doesn't shake it. Doesn't do anything. So now the question is, where am I emotionally, right? And the question would be, am I in a place of emptiness, numbness? Or where am I? And these are questions that I ask, like, I ask myself these questions, because one of my problems, or my issues is also that, I'm a problem solver. So I like to decipher things, including myself, and, checking on myself is crucial. So I always have to check where I'm at, and according to where I feel like I'm at, I'm in a state of anhedonia. And, you know, anhedonia. Yeah. Anhedonia. Anhedonia. Yes. I'm in a state of anhedonia. And the part of depression that causes a persistent inability to feel joy, pleasure, or intense in previous joy, interest in previous enjoyed activities is known as anhedonia. Anhedonia. Woo! Like, we're struggling with words these days. Anhedonia. It is a core symptom of major depressive disorder, categorized by emotional numbness, a flat or empty feeling, and reduced motivation, often described as living in black and white. So that is where I feel I'm at. I think I'm there, but I wasn't always there. So am I getting worse or am I getting better? Because at least, like prior, I was at least feeling, you know, happy sometimes, you know, joyous sometimes, what sometimes. And now I'm like,
Everything's like, okay. Maybe. Like, okay. And I don't know. I'm just here to talk. Because part of my fears is also being on the cover page of the newspaper and being yet another statistic in this country. And I don't want to be a statistic, you know. And that's why I'm fighting, you know. I'm fighting. The number in studio is 083-288-401. That is the number in studio. It's 083-288-401. Maybe you've also felt like this. Maybe you've also been down and under and down on your luck. Maybe you can call in and then we can soothe one another. Because these are days that are dark, you know, for me at least. These are days that are dark and these are days that I'm just somewhat, I'm not really coping. And I'm not really, I'm not doing as well as I would like to be doing. And yeah. So, anhedonia. Anhedonia is derived from the Greek. It means without pleasure. It is the reduced ability to experience joy. So imagine if you're a person that has mad dopamine, and you know, one of the weirdest things also that's happening right now is that my punchlines and my jokes are hella deep and hella funny. Like everybody around me is laughing, like laughing away. I'm telling the jokes. Like if you know, I should actually go and have like one of those Free Your Mind shows where I'm going to, or even come to Mind the Gap with Helmut, because my jokes these days, man, they are giving. It's giving vibes upon vibes upon vibes, you know, and it's really honestly giving. And I'm like, yeah, nah, but I'm not that funny, you know, and people are cracking up, you know, they're forgetting their problems and they're cracking and they're laughing and yo. And I'm watching people laugh and I'm watching people, you know, have fun with it, especially, you know, if I'm having a conversation in the cab or I'm having a conversation somewhere, because for some weird reason, I always have to say something. And I'm watching the joy on other people's faces and I'm like, wow, that's nice. But I can tell you right now that even I'm telling my jokes with a straight face. And usually, when you're in a good space, you also laugh at your own joke, right? Because no matter how many times you have memorized it as a comedian, you would always laugh at your own joke because you know the context of it. And also you know that it's funny, right? You know it's funny. So you laugh at the joke also when you're telling the joke. But I'm telling my jokes with a straight face, sis. I'm telling my jokes with a straight face and a straight, you know, straight demeanor and everything. I'm even doing the side eye thing. And I'm watching everybody around me happy. You know, I'm watching them. I'm watching them laugh and smile. And I'm watching them crack up and say, no, man, I'm going to pee myself. And I'm like, wow, I miss that. I miss being happy. I miss being ecstatic and excited. I miss being enthusiastic. I miss everything about everything that I feel that I have somehow, it's either neglected, abandoned, or it left. You know? And I'm just thinking about it like, oh, like wow. Now I get it, like, and I get it because my heart is so heavy and I'm so tired and I'm sighing and I'm breathing in it. And it's wild. You know? So I feel like I'm in that state. But obviously we're going to have to confirm this with the psychologist. We're going to have to confirm this tomorrow. We're going to have to confirm if that's where I'm at. But also underneath anhedonia,
there is also emotional numbness. Instead of deep sadness, individuals often feel a profound empty numbness, a meh feeling, or a totally lack of emotional response. And I don't think that I'm there yet. But the meh is coming along, like, okay, you know. And then there's loss of interest, you know. Hobbies, socializing, favorite food, and relationships no longer bring satisfaction or joy. Yeah. And one would wonder, how do you get out of this? Like, you know, every time people speak about depression, the other one, the stereotype always comes up, which is always you happy ones. And I don't think I'm happy. I think that maybe my voice is just familiar. I think maybe you guys are just accustomed to the voice. And there's no way I can talk sad. Like, this is the saddest I can go, guys. Like, this is me. I'm sad. Like, you know, I think it's because also, it's not really to say that I'm masking sadness or depression in humor. I really am just hilarious, if I may say so myself, you know, of which I just did. So I don't know. And then there's brain mechanism. It is associated with a breakdown in the brain's reward system. Also, often involving lower levels of dopamine. So that means there's a lower level of dopamine. Or I feel that there is. And then, dysfunction from sadness. While sadness is feeling down, anhedonia is feeling nothing. Yo. So that's where I'm at, ladies and gentlemen, in case you're wondering. Like, what's happening here? I think I'm here. But because even with anger, even with longing, even if with what, it's a short circuit. And I've always been a short circuit when it comes to anger, because I don't stay angry for long, and it takes a very long time for me to get angry as well. But I'm in that, okay. Like, if I'm angry, it's like, I don't even get angry the way I should get angry. I don't get excited the way I should get excited. I'm just out here. Like, yo. And it's a scary place to be. It's a very scary place to be, because when the sadness comes, it comes in waves and waves and waves. And when the hopelessness comes, it comes in waves and waves. And then there's a total lack of emotional response, and it's just, okay. Okay. All right. And I don't know. But lucky for us, we take these things very seriously, and in these things, we will surely find ways to cope and to manage and to find a little bit of joy within the dark and gloomy days. But yeah, that's anhedonia. And that is a state in which you get as a person. Now, what is the treatment and management? The treatment, anhedonia is treated through therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, medication, antidepressants, and lifestyle changes such as building a structured routine to foster a sense of accomplishment. So you have to feel like you have rewarded yourself, like you have achieved something. And that's how you get over it, or you treat it. But also with therapy and with medication and structure and routine.
and recovery. While it can feel permanent, the brain's neuroplasticity allows for the return of pleasure and motivation with appropriate treatment. So it's not, we're not doomed. We just have to find ways in which our brain is going to work on it and how we are going to, how we're going to get there, you know? We're not doomed. It's just that we're having a tough time right now. And that tough time, it comes with its own ups and its own down, and it's just one of those, right? And part of our quest is that we are all trying, and we're all trying to cope, and we're all trying to manage, and we're all trying our utmost and level best to do our parts, right? So with doing our parts, we would try and describe what we are going through. So, ladies and gentlemen, please stay tuned.
Lipura nengeno wapumbwa eva tere ulikoni maondo tuto ingida ashike kapeno nweku dite opoye ekukurile oshafafana nongeshefa ili mehola mo iho etike kovano ile koshiwana onongeshefa ya pumbwa kukaraya kovano okupitira mo Eagle FM otuna emito danjuka okukwetira oipindi konu kwa ndado inawa nune udo otukwetira o special ange tashake ngeshefa omarudi dayo loka opone ushendife nawa nokumona oijamo ili nawa ninge kwa tafanona monika ko Eagle FM onore satimwe bali heali.
Care that builds with you. That's the rollover benefit from NHB. When you claim less than a defined amount of your day-to-day benefits in a year, the unused amount is carried over for the next year, like a savings account for your health. You can use your rollover benefit in many ways, from co-payments to medical costs usually not covered, even contribution holidays. Learn more at nhb.com.na. T's and C's apply. NHB, rooted in care for you.
Your health, your life, your peace of mind. NHB, we're about you.
Po Eagle FM, onore tatuimwe bali heali, nola natu, heali bali no heali. Ileko berewa, nora hetatu natu, bali o hetatu watatu, o mafelane, Eagle FM, the eye.
Alrighty, good evening to you. If you have just joined us, this is Pulling Heartstrings with the Matriarch. And the heartstrings that we are pulling this evening is that of major depressive disorder, something that I suffer from. And we are just trying to find ways in coping, and we're just trying to talk about it, create a little bit of awareness around it. And tonight we're talking about the state of anhedonia. Anhedonia, anhedonia, anhedonia. The clip that we're about to play, ladies and gentlemen, we as Eagle Media House do not claim any ownership of it. It's strictly for us to learn and for us to hear what others are saying about it. And stay tuned.
Talk a lot on this channel about the importance of having and executing a sound strategy for managing your mental health, of generally knowing how you're going to allocate your time and energy each day, making sure you're putting it into the places that are most likely to help you improve your mental health and fight back against these symptoms that you experience, and of how important it is to work hard at this and basically apply the same strategies to managing your mental health that you would at anything else in life that you were trying to do well. And for the most part, I do believe in this message. I do believe that we are the strategies that get us in the best possible place that we're capable of being. However, I do know that there is one thing that makes the mental health journey very different from any other endeavor that you might undertake or any other goals that you might have for yourself. And that is that for many of us who are struggling with our mental health, we at times experience this feeling of complete and total apathy towards ourselves, our lives, our goals, and the plan doesn't seem to matter on those days or weeks or months or however long they last. You can have a perfect plan, and if you don't care if it works or not, you're not likely to execute the plan during that period of time. And these periods of time then are always going to represent these massive setbacks in our progress, because there are times when we just couldn't make ourselves do anything, couldn't get going, couldn't get out of bed, couldn't help ourselves, couldn't ask for help. They just shut us down completely, or at least it seems like they would. I have been able, particularly in the last few years, to find a couple ways around this thing that I once thought was not solvable, not something that we could actually fight back against, something we just had to deal with and accept. Like, when this happens, you're just going to stop. And I think that's the general consensus of most of the therapists I know, too, is like that there's periods of time when people just can't, like when there's no way that they're going to be able to do anything. I don't know if I believe that is true anymore. I know that it is not true for me. And I want to be clear on this. I still experience those times. They don't last nearly as long as they used to. They don't happen nearly as frequently as they used to. But I have not found a way to completely rid myself of those what I call black hole periods. The times when it feels like, what is the point of all this? What is the difference? You know, why bother putting in all this time, all this work, all this effort, if sometimes it does nothing? If I can still wake up randomly and be like, I'm empty, I'm hollow, everything feels pointless. For most of my life, those periods of time have controlled me and they have dictated the course of my life. And even though they still happen and I don't yet know how to completely prevent them from happening, they don't control me anymore. In fact, if you've been following this channel for any length of time, you've probably seen me in one of those periods. You probably didn't realize it because I probably looked the exact same as I normally do, for better or for worse. I don't know what that says about me. But today I'm going to teach you the two main strategies that I have learned in my own personal life that have helped me push through these periods of apathy and anhedonia and emptiness and numbness and stay on track with doing the things that I need to do. The first, it's not funny, but I might laugh a little bit when I describe it because it is so ridiculous and counterintuitive, but also makes so much sense that I'm kind of amused that I never thought about it before. When we get this feeling of just complete and total emptiness and just this I don't care about anything attitude, we also have the option to apply the apathy to our apathy. In other words, you can choose to not care about the fact that you do not care. Call it apathyception if you'd like. And if you don't care that you don't care, then you can keep doing the things you think you need to do for a prolonged period of time, even if during that period of time, you don't care about doing those things, because you also don't care that you don't care. It's not our normal reaction, right? When we hit those periods where we realize,
now that one is wild. You don't care about not caring. Like, you don't care about not caring. You don't care, yes, but you also don't care that you don't care. So you are going to do the things that you need to do because you don't care that you don't care. Wow. Did you guys see that? Like, the energy that I started with, and then now all of a sudden I have a lot of energy, like, I don't know, episodes.
As suddenly I feel nothing. The normal response would be, well, if I feel nothing, then I'm going to do nothing. Why would I bother doing anything if I feel nothing? Or I'm going to just do the things that I think have the best chance of, like, making me feel some amount, potentially, even if it's just a fraction, tiny little bit, positive emotionality today. Especially things that take no effort, right? Because I feel like I have nothing to give this day. So I'm either going to not do anything, or I'm going to do things like watch TV, play video games, like things that basically I can do no matter how I feel. And I might feel nothing, or I might feel a little bit of something from them. But if you think that no matter what you're going to do on that particular day, the result is going to be an emotional void and you aren't going to enjoy your activities or your choices, no matter what they are, then why not pick the ones that put you in the best place for later if you're not going to be in a good place today, no matter what you do? It reminds me a little bit, I hope this is not an invalidating metaphor, but it reminds me a little bit of like when you're a kid and you go to Walmart or something with your parents and they're like, you have $10, you know, go find something you want for $10. And looking back on it, this might be a sign that I struggled with depression for a long time. Because I remember sometimes I'd be like, oh, I don't want anything. Like, this is all crap. I don't care about any of it. But I have $10, so I should spend it on something, right? And I would just buy something stupid that I didn't care about and would forget about in a day. And looking back, you know, I know the answer is, like, I was a kid with tiny frontal lobes. But looking back on it, it's like, why didn't you just save the money? Like, if you couldn't find anything you wanted on that day, why not reserve that for a time later when you want something? Because you know you will want something later because you're a kid and you'll find a toy you want. You know that you will feel better later, right? Like, I'm not saying everything, you're going to wake up one day and everything's going to be fine. But you know that these periods of just complete and total apathy and emptiness do not last forever. Because you've had them before. And you've also not had them. I don't know how long they're going to last. Like, I wish I could just be psychic and tell you. But it won't last forever. And so if you know that there is going to come a point in the future when you do care, why not continue to behave as if you do care, even when you don't? Because the end result today is going to be the same whether you make, and I'm sorry to say this in an oversimplified manner, but I think you know what I mean, whether you make good or bad choices, if you're going to feel bad, even if you make, whether you make good choices or bad choices, doesn't it still make the most sense to make the so-called good choices? Because then when this episode eventually ends, you will not be in a massive lifestyle deficit that you have to claw your way out of to get back to the baseline that you were at in the first place. One other silly metaphor I have from this. About 2.5 years ago, my wife got COVID. And I apparently didn't get COVID. So I stayed, she had it rough. She was bedridden and pretty much non-functional. So I'm like, okay, I'll call home, you know, I'll call in from work. I'll stay home with the kids and, you know, keep them entertained and so you can rest. And there was one day I remember we went to a pizza place. I took the kids out to a pizza restaurant that we'd never been to before. And they were hungry and I wasn't. So I was just like sitting there watching them eat. And they are both just like raving about how good this pizza is. And I'm like, all right, fine. I'm like, let me try it. You guys aren't going to finish your pizza, I know. So I take a bite and I'm eating. I'm like, are you guys pranking me? This is disgusting. This literally just tastes like cardboard. And they're like, no, it's so good. What is wrong with you? I'm like, there's nothing. This is just junk. I didn't know what that meant right away. But then that night I was taking a shower and I was washing my hair and I was washing my body. And I'm like, this is weird. I don't smell my shampoo. I don't smell my body wash. So I'd like put it right under my nose. And I tried to smell it. I'm like, I don't smell anything. And then I'm like, oh, I have COVID. Because that was my, it was so weird. That was my only symptom, was lack of taste, lack of smell. And for like a little bit, I was kind of doom and gloom. I'm like, my food is going to taste like, I couldn't taste anything. Everything just tasted like mush. So eating was miserable. It literally just was like untextured, unflavored gruel. It was awful. And at first I was like trying to make things that I thought I would like anyway, like maybe if it's really spicy or has a lot of salt, nothing broke through. I could not taste anything. And after a full day trying to make the most delicious meals I could think of to try to break through this lack of taste, then I had this light bulb moment. I was like, if everything tastes disgusting anyway, I should just eat the healthiest possible foods. Because normally, I'll be honest with you guys, I'm not a hypocrite, because I tell you that the specifics of nutrition don't matter as much for mood and anxiety. I'm very serious about like eating my 3 meals a day and my couple snacks, but I suck at vegetables. I am so bad at them because I think they taste like garbage. And I realized, if everything tastes like garbage anyway, this is my moment. This is my window for however long this symptom lasts. I'm going to get my veggies in. So I went out and bought like just the healthiest foods I could think of, you know, like broccoli and plain Greek yogurt and cottage cheese. And just like, my nutrition was perfect.
And ladies and gentlemen, I know that you guys were like, yeah, man, this guy. Yeah, but I'm here. Hello. Hi. I'm here. So basically what he's trying to say is that when you are in the state of anhedonia,
right? That is the state of feeling emptiness, numbness, nothing. Like, nothing is nice anymore. Nothing tastes good. Nothing. Life is not worth enjoying. Life is not nice. You know, when you're in that state, the idea is to keep doing the things that you think, ne, that you still have to do. Like, still take the kids to school, please. Still wake up tomorrow to take the kids to school. Because it's going to be a bad day tomorrow anyways, you might as well do the things that you know that you're supposed to do. And I think that this is somehow, some way, the breakthrough through the depression, right? Because if you keep laying down and if you keep sulking and if you keep sleeping and if you just keep giving in to the disease, right? Then you would most probably like end up doing something that you really shouldn't have done or you really wouldn't do on a normal day. But it's because your dopamine is so flat and your mood is so low, so extremely low that nothing, you just feel nothing at all. But if you keep doing the little things that don't taste, that don't taste good, and that's why he was talking about food, for example, everything tastes bad. Like when you're depressed, right? I'm so mesmerized by people that eat through pain. I'm like, wow, you can be sad and still eat. Like, yeah, give me that pup. Like, I still want it. Give me the chicken wings also. Yeah, like put on extra sauce. Like, yeah, yeah. I'm very amazed by those people because I'm so emotional that I can't eat when I'm sad and I can't eat when I'm too happy and I can't eat through emotions, right? But other people can just get it right. I have an aunt of mine, right, with her small, tiny baby fingers. And she eats even on her wasted days. When she's like wasted, she eats food, guys. She eats no matter what. Yara anonjarangui. Never forever. Yara anonjara. Like, no matter how drunk she is, she will eat. And I think it's the same thing for depressed people, right? That are now on the quest to finding a little bit of happiness and a little bit of, to raise their dopamine because it's neuroplasticity, right? We're supposed to give ourselves routines to make us feel happiness and to make us feel joy and to make us feel motivated and to make us feel inspired and so forth, right? So what he's saying is that if everything tastes bad because you're depressed, right? Everything tastes bad. How about you get the most healthiest things in while you're depressed and then your nutrition is going to look great? Or how about, right, if life sucks so much, then why not just start exercising so that you have a killer body? So that you're depressed and hot at the same time. Like, what will it do? It will still just feel bad. It will still just be bad. It will just, you will still be unhappy anyways. Why don't you just do something that is beneficial? Example, still put on the electricity. Example, still pay your bills. Example, still keep going. Example, still keep going to work. Example, keep trying. Because those, there are little spats of energy that pop in. And those little spats of energy that pop in, right? They are the spats that spark something within you. And tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is pure divine intervention, eh? For me, to be pure divine intervention, because me, in my heart of hearts today, I was going to come here and I was going to tell my boss because I saw my boss. I was going to tell my boss that me, I'm not feeling well. I'm going home. I'm not feeling well, I'm going home. And today, lucky for me, I didn't have the heart to continue with my conversation. So I was like, let me just go and try. And right now, I can honestly say that 47 minutes past the hour of 9, that there's a little bit of a kick that came in. There's a little bit of a happiness that came in. You know, there's a little something that came in. And I think it is exactly what our guy here is talking about, because keep doing it, because even if there is just a little bit of joy and a little bit of satisfaction that you get out of it, it is better than that flat line that you've been on. And eventually you raise your dopamine and you will raise your emotions and you will raise it and raise it and raise it. It's like,
like reprogramming your mind to feel joy and pleasure. And you do it through little things, right? While still doing things that taste like meh.
For like a week, until my sense of taste came back and everything tasted like crap. And then I binged on goldfish because that's how life works. But I made the most of my lack of my ability to enjoy my food and therefore just did the optimal thing because it was the same. It felt the same. And I'm not trying to paint some stupid silver lining on this awful, hollow, empty feeling we get sometimes. But if nothing feels good, you may as well do the best things. You have nothing to lose because it's not going to feel good that day anyway. If you're incapable of feeling good on that day, do something that puts you in the best possible position to maybe feel good tomorrow or next week or next month. Apathyception. The other thing I found that really helped, and it's honestly a pretty similar concept, but it's a different framework, and so it might land differently for you, is rather than living a life of trying to feel some certain way, which I think is sort of our default. Like, we want to live a life that feels good, right? Whatever good, of course, is a very broad category. Some of us are more looking for excitement. Some of us want achievement. Some of us want love. I mean, we all want all of these things, but some of us want certain feelings more than others, right? And we have certain feelings that we kind of just chase and try to organize our lives around. But organizing your life around the pursuit of a certain emotional experience is always going to put you on sort of this roller coaster of, like, there's times when you have it and there's times when you don't. Sometimes you don't have it because you just can't. There's nothing you can do right now that's going to make you feel that way. There's just not an opportunity for it. But for people like you and me who get this complete and total apathy and anhedonia sometimes we just can't feel the feeling even if we're doing the things that should produce the feeling. And so if you're doing the thing because you want the feeling, then as soon as the feeling stops being available to you, you will stop doing the thing. I have completely changed my goal setting framework for this because I have learned, and I'm not trying to villainize emotions. Emotions are important. Like, I just made a content on that. I know, like, emotions are not the bad guy. And I mean that. And I still mean that today, just as much as I meant it a week ago. But emotions are fickle. Emotions are not consistent, especially if you have a cyclical mood disorder or an anxiety disorder. There's going to be times when you simply cannot trust your ability to feel the emotions you want to feel. And so if you're living your life in pursuit of emotions that at times will completely evade you no matter what you do, you have guaranteed that there are going to be times when you do nothing. Because there's not going to be a connection between your actions and the outcomes that you're hoping to achieve during those periods of complete apathy. So I have reorganized my entire internal goals from away from emotions and towards the actions themselves. I have committed myself to unchanging. Well, they're not completely unchanging because I do over long periods of time rethink, you know, my lifestyle and the way I've structured my days and stuff. So it's not like set it and forget it for the rest of your life. Unchanging meaning it's not shackled to my emotional experience because that experience is a roller coaster. And if I live my life based on my emotions, my functioning will fluctuate dramatically because my emotions fluctuate dramatically. If I live my life based on the structured goals that I believe are necessary for me to achieve the best possible outcome over a long time frame, then I do not have to live as a slave to my emotions. And I am able to continue to do the things that I need to do, like create content for YouTube, for example, even on days when I feel no immediate sense of joy or excitement or satisfaction or reward from doing those things. Because I've essentially decided, and like, I don't know if it was that simple or if it wasn't, but I've essentially decided that I'm okay with the things I'm doing not always producing the feelings that I want them to produce. And during those periods of time, like, I don't panic about them anymore. I don't freak out about them. I'm not like, oh no, it's another one of these. This is going to ruin all the momentum I've built up. This is going to shut me down. It's more like, oh, it sucks. I really didn't want this right now. Like, I would really prefer to be enjoying my life right now. I would prefer to be feeling good. It looks like for some indeterminate period of time in the future, I'm not going to be able to have that. I really wish that were not true, but it is. And so I'm going to do the things that I think have the best possible chance of this being a relatively short blip on my radar. I'm going to continue to live the lifestyle that I think is going to get me out of this the quickest, because I hate it and I'm really excited for it to be over so I can go back to being able to experience my emotions again. So some days I just say, screw feelings, focus on the action, because my feelings change, but my goals really don't change, not on a daily basis anyway. And within this idea of goal setting, I have talked about this before on this channel, so this might be a little bit of review for some of you, but it's so relevant to this topic that it's worth reviewing. There are two types of goals that we can set: process goals and outcome goals. Process goals are the things we hope to achieve, and outcome goals are what we hope the things we achieve will produce or will do. So for example, if I say that I have the goal of being happier in my life in general, that's an outcome goal, because I can do things that should make me happier and not necessarily feel that way. If I have a goal of saving $10,000 this year and I set up the budget just right, and I follow the budget and I do everything in a way that should have produced that outcome, and then we get an unexpected home repair that takes most of that $10,000 away, I have not saved $10,000, right? Maybe I'm left with $2,000, but I did everything right. And so I end up in that situation because the actions I took did not produce the outcome I had hoped they would produce. I end up feeling like a failure. I end up feeling like I screwed up, because the outcome didn't happen, but the outcome is not completely within my control. And that's true of virtually any outcome in your life, whether it is internal or external. The outcomes you hope will happen are due to some combination of your own personal choices and actions and other people's choices and actions and random chance and the will of the world and whatever else, right? This is a very philosophical tangent right now, I know. We are not in complete control of our lives. We're not. You are not. If you looked at your life like a research project and you said, you know, the quality of my life and the things that happen in my life are the dependent variable, they are the outcome, they are the output, you are not the only independent variable. It is not a one-to-one. You can do everything right and still not get what you want sometimes. And it's not fair and it sucks, but you need to know it and you need to factor it in, because if you don't, you will blame yourself every time that happens, even when it is not your fault. Many times it may not be your fault, or at least not entirely your fault. So if you can commit to setting process goals instead of outcomes, I want to go for a walk 5 days a week. I hope that going for a walk 5 days a week will improve my mood, but sometimes it won't. Sometimes I won't care that I went for a walk. Sometimes I will feel no sense of peace during the walk, no sense of accomplishment after having done it. But if I'm having one of those days, I would have felt no sense of peace or no sense of accomplishment anyway. So it's not like the walk was a bad idea or ruined my progress. Sometimes I just can't progress, but I want to keep doing the things. I want to stick with process goals, even when the outcome eludes me, because I have learned through experience, through trial and error, it'll come back. And when it comes back, I want to be ready for it. I want the day I am capable of feeling good again to be the day I feel good again. I do not want there to be a lag time where I am capable of feeling good again, but I'm not doing the things that would produce that feeling, because then it is my fault. And I know it's going to happen sometimes. I accept it. It's part of how I'm built. Don't know why I'm built that way, but I am. It's part of how I'm built, but sometimes I just can't feel these things. But I want to make sure that I am not the reason ever again, because for far too much of my life, I have been the reason. Not going to let that happen anymore. And these are the strategies I use to keep that monster at bay. I hope that they are helpful to you, and I hope that they work for you as well. Take care. I'll see you next time.
In the preamble to the definition of PTSD, we write, these people.
And I think that that was a good one, because it also definitely, definitely lifted my mood. You guys all know that we started off this show with like, wah, 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 wah. All right, we missed out on that caller. But ladies and gentlemen, the number in studio is 083-288-401. That is 083-288-401. So, we started off our show with...
And now we're in a better mood. We're in a better mood. We're in a better mood. So there was a conversation around apathy and anhedonia. Hey, that one we must say it slowly. Because wait a minute. So there's apathy and anhedonia. Yeah, so those are the conversations, because generally we're talking about depression today, but we're also having our speakers come in and we're going to be interjecting like rude people, because
people have been exposed to an extraordinary event that's outside of normal human experience. So it turned out that this is not an unusual experience at all. The trauma is not the event that happens. The trauma is how you respond to it. The degree to which, when you're traumatized, your body keeps mobilizing itself to fight. You have all kind of immunological abnormalities. You have endocrine abnormalities. And that really devastates your health, your physical health. At the long range, oftentimes the physical problems are longer lasting than the mental problems. One of the largest mitigating factors against getting traumatized is who is there for you at that particular time. I did the first study on Prozac for PTSD, the first study for Zoloft for PTSD, and a number of other conventional drugs. What we found is that it didn't work very well. Hi, my name is Bessel van der Kolk. I'm a psychiatrist, neuroscientist, the author of the book, The Body Keeps the Score.
Chapter 1, Trauma Explained.
I got interested in trauma on my first day working at the Veterans Administration.
Fall in love with the best prices at WB. Get 500-gram Bokomo cornflakes for $31.99. 2 kg Nice Rice for only $34.99. 1.5 kg Real Good Mixed Chicken Portions for $79.99. And 10 kg Bokomo Fat Cook Flour for just $137.99. See more February specials at Voermanbrock.com. We care.
If you lost your show, all of that is good to go. Oma wa o tomono okujako NHP. Genge wa longi fae longi fo li lipedu lo wa wo uhaku. Olo halipiti kwa efiku ne fiku. Mefiloshi shelo uhaku oe. Owa washi mali wa o shosha kupako. Washika wet gelu wa komto alandu. Akukashi. Koma punglo e na shano unjola welewe. Otodulu okulongi fa oma wa oe. Wa hupuko. Opo una mitito shiningi momikalo dihapungashi. Okufuti lapo oi mali wa ishona. Oyo hodulu okupolwa. Ulifutila ove mwene, omayakulo olu hapu, hakala ina kwa telwa, mowawe kwa folo elu unamiti. Ile, oto julu no kuli, okupitifapo e mwedi donumba, tokala ino futa ea kulolo elu unamiti. Kowyalele uhapu, talela po nhp.com.na. Emango nomalandola fwana ododi na okulandulwa. NHP, rooted in care for you.
Your life, your peace of mind. NHP, we're about you.
My friend. But the very first day that I met Vietnam veterans, I was just blown away. These were guys who were my age, who were clearly smart and competent and had done very good things, flying helicopters and running boats and doing good stuff in the military, and they clearly were just a shadow of their former self. And what particularly intrigued me is that they had nightmares about what had happened, and also that they kept referring back to their dead comrades. Their hearts seemed to be with the people who were no longer around, and what struck me immediately is that they had a very hard time connecting with new people after the war. But also struck me is how their bodies were clearly affected by trauma. These were guys who used to be athletic, and now they were sort of slumped over, and they were uptight, and their voices were uptight, and they were sort of passive much of the time, and then people told them something that was disappointing, and they went from 0 to 10 and blew up and became extremely angry. And it was just at the time that we were having two small children who were a little bit like that. You know, they were little babies go from 0 to 10. But I know that when a baby becomes very upset, within 10 minutes you can sort of hold them and calm them down. And these soldiers were very much like little babies, except the stuff that's supposed to happen to allow you to not overreact to the minor things seemed to have been destroyed, or something seemed to have happened to that that made it very hard for them to modulate their responses to the environment. And what was also really striking is that they had a hard time being in any way meaningfully involved in the present. They had a hard time loving their wives and girlfriends. They had a hard time really connecting with their kids. So something seems to have been destroyed about their capacity to engage and possibly even to learn new experiences. 1978 was the year that I first saw veterans. And that was also the time that my colleagues, and I soon joined them, started to think about how is what these guys suffer from different from what other people who are in psychology textbooks, because clearly they were different, and I couldn't find a textbook to describe them. Around that time that I first started to work for the VA, a group of us started to define what trauma is and started to define what happens to people. In the preamble to the definition of PTSD, we write, these people have been exposed to an extraordinary event that's outside of normal human experience. And in retrospect, that shows us how ignorant and narrow-minded we were, because it turned out that this is not an unusual experience at all, that 1 out of 5 women in America has a history of sexual molestation. Even a lot of men have histories of sexual molestation. 1 out of 4 kids get beaten very hard by their parents. 1 out of 8 kids see physical fights between their parents. When we started to work with inner city kids, the amount of trauma that these kids experienced was just unspeakable. So somehow we had managed to turn a completely blind eye how what happens in people's environment creates the mind and creates who people become and creates certain forms of pathology. It was a real wake-up call. And there was a lot of debate of what a trauma is to this day. And even sometimes when I define it in the way we officially do, people still don't like what I say. But basically, what a trauma is something that happens to you that makes you so upset that it overwhelms you. It freaks you out, and you cannot. You just stand there or sit there or lie there or whatever, and you are at a loss what to do. You feel terrible, helpless, hopeless, and you collapse. Basically, there's an internal state of, oh my God. So it's not somebody being mean to you or nasty to you, or it is really bad stuff. But the trauma is not the event that happens. The trauma is how you respond to it. Let me give you an example. As a medical student, I was trained to deal with all kind of very difficult situations. And I remember vividly during my internship that a kid was brought in, a little child, with third-degree burn wounds all over his body. But I was trained as a medical student about what to do. So rather than freaking out, I thought, okay, I need to get my IV going, I need my fluids going. I focused on what to do. So that exposure to these horribly burned kids was not a trauma for me, because I was not paralyzed in my actions, because I had been trained to deal with it. And of course, that happens to policemen, that happens to people in the service, it happens to physicians, nurses, etc. Is that you get trained on what to do, and not to get overwhelmed by your feelings, but to actually be able to continue to act and do something. And when you're traumatized, you just are unable to do anything. It's a subjective experience, and what may be traumatic for you may not be traumatic for me, vice versa, depending on our personality and our training. An event becomes traumatic if your response is oh my God. I mean, there is nothing you can think of you can do to stave off the inevitable, where you basically collapse in a state of confusion, maybe rage, maybe collapse, because you are unable to function in the face of this particular threat. An event like that may not become a trauma in the long range if at the moment that you collapse, other people around you come over and say, oh, I see that you're really in bad shape. Let me help you. Let me take over for you and do things that you cannot do yourself. And so the greatest protector against the trauma is the people around you, whether they're able to protect you and to do what needs to be done, or whether the people around you actually make it worse by continuing to do terrible things to you or blaming you for your responses. Trauma is actually, unlike what we first thought, extremely common. At least one out of 8 kids in America witness physical violence between their parents. A larger number of kids get hit in very nasty ways by their own caregivers. A very large number of people in general, but women in particular, have sexual experiences that were clearly unwanted and that left them helpless and befuddled, confused and enraged because they had no choice about what they were doing. These experiences are extremely common. So people usually think about the military when they talk about trauma, but I like to say, somewhat unscientifically, that for every soldier who gets PTSD in a war zone, there's at least 30 children who get traumatized at home. The nature of trauma is that an experience enters into your ears, into your skin, into your eyes, into sensations, and it goes down into a very primitive part of your brain that automatically interprets what is going on. That's not your frontal lobe. What your frontal lobe, your conscious cognitive self does, is a later issue. The first thing is a somatic response. So something happens to you, your survival brain makes the first interpretation and says, is this dangerous or is this safe? That decision is made for you by that primitive survival brain. And that's what we learned a lot about when we study trauma, is the power of that primitive brain, which occupies a very large part of our brain, that really automatically makes decisions for us. And on the basis of the messages we get from our body, our cognition interprets in a particular way, depending on our prior experiences. But the message comes from our hormones and our physiological impulses that have to do with survival. We're talking about staying alive. And so when you're being raped or you're being beaten or you see your parents getting killed, your body starts automatically going into a state trying to make yourself survive. One of the states is going into fight flight, to get up and to punch people and to become very angry. And that's oftentimes when people are traumatized, those fight flight responses continue to get activated in response to situations where people in their environment says, hey, cool it. This is not so bad, but people have these automatic responses. Or on a more primitive level even, is that people's brain shuts down and they lose track of themselves and they basically make themselves disappear. Very much like animals can do that also in the wild. They can sort of collapse and play possum, as it were. And playing possum is exactly what happens to people also. And when you beat a kid enough, that kid starts collapsing and no longer responds to its environment. And so it is either fight flight or collapse, none of which have anything to do with cognition. And doing cognitive therapy with that is really a misunderstanding of what happens with traumatized people. They have automatic responses, and they don't have these responses because they're stupid or because they don't understand what's going on. Most people actually do understand that their reactions are completely out of whack. They don't need to be told that. But because they react in such an extreme way, they feel deeply ashamed about themselves because they say to themselves, I'm a nutcake. I screamed at people. I collapsed when I had to stand up for myself. And so you have these automatic responses that are not a product of your cognitive assessment. They're a product of your animal brain trying to stay alive in the face of something that that part of your brain interprets as a life threat. Even though the people around you by now go, this is not a life threat at all. We come into the world being able to do what little babies can do. And what can little babies do? They can breathe, they can sleep, they can suck, they can feel hungry, they can poop, they can pee, they can cry, and that's about it. So we call that the housekeeping of the body. Little babies already can do that. And little babies, their systems get very activated, so babies will scream and they'll cry and they'll look catastrophic. And then the people around them pick them up and soothe them and calm that part of the brain down. Much of the imprint of trauma is in a very primitive survival part of your brain that's already in place in little babies. In fact, what the research recently has been showing is a little area way the base of your skull, peri-aqueductal gray, that I like to call the cockroach brain. There's a part of you that just picks up what's dangerous and what's safe. And now it turns out that when you're traumatized, that little part of your brain, which is usually very quiet for most of us, continues to just send messages to you when you're traumatized. And so there's always this sort of message you get from deep down inside of your body of, I'm in danger, I'm not safe. So you're always uptight, always on alert, and you spend much of your energy trying to suppress those feelings of fear in order to not to embarrass yourself, in order to be able to work with what you do. And so it's very primitive. And then on top of that middle of the primitive part of your brain, you develop a limbic system, and your limbic system basically creates an internal map of the world that tells you what out there is safe, what is dangerous. So if you say to me, boy, after this interview is over, let's go to the Star and plow down the street and have a nice lager beer, I go like, wow, that's so cool because I love that bar and I don't love that bar. So already in my internal mind, I have a map of what is safe and what's dangerous. And that map is created by the experiences we have. So the brain is a use-dependent organ, and the brain gets formed on the basis of the experiences that we have, particularly in the first few years of your life. And so if you're a little kid and you grow up in very safe surroundings and people are delighted to see you and people say, isn't she cute? Isn't she wonderful? You grow up with a sense of, I'm so cute. And people love me, because that becomes the map of your world. That's how people respond to you. And that basically that stays with you for much of the rest of your life. If you're a little kid and people say to you, as I hear all the time, I wish you hadn't been born. I tried to abort you, but I fail. You just really ruined my life. You're just have always been a pain in the ass. That becomes your map of the world. And a little kid doesn't say when you're 3 years old or 5 years old, Mom, you're crazy saying that about me, because a little kid doesn't have other ways of looking at the world. So the world that you live in is the only world that it is. And if you're being treated as a difficult, unpleasant person, that becomes your perception of yourself. I'm fundamentally a bad, a defective person. And that people's cognition does not make that go away. People can tell you till you're blue in the face, oh, you're wonderful, you're terrific. I've known a whole bunch of people like that who were very abused and neglected as kids, who have become amazing musicians, artists, athletes. The world adores them, and deep inside, they still feel like crap, that they're defective people, because that imprint stays with them. My colleagues and I started to look at these traumatized soldiers primarily. We actually went back over what had been written before. The library at the VA I was working didn't have a single book about war trauma, war neurosis, any of these things. But so I went down to the old Harvard Medical Library and I dug up a book that was written in 1941 by a guy by the name of Abram Gardner, who had been working with First World War soldiers. And he writes about his First World War soldiers back a long time ago. He writes, these guys suffer from a physioneurosis. Their bodies continue to re-experience the trauma. And he says, and the trauma keeps coming back, keeps revisiting them in the form of nightmares and flashbacks. They keep reliving what happened back there. They cannot leave it behind. And the trauma keeps coming back either as images or as behaviors. As the people behave again as if they are getting raped or getting assaulted, even though they are not getting raped or getting assaulted. So, but we defined, but people had seen that before us, all the way back to well over 100 years. At the core of trauma is that you get stuck, and that event keeps coming back in terms of images, behaviors, and physical sensations. So that became at the core of our definition of PTSD. The second piece is that having been constantly bombarded with this horrifying stuff makes you preoccupied with how do I go on with my life? And so you work very hard on avoiding things that make you lose your senses. And so people avoid and people suppress it, and people actually learn to not feel things in their bodies, and they stifle internal sensations, internal feelings. So that's the second piece is, on the one side, is this fight-flight keeps going on. The other thing is you calm yourself down, you try to suppress yourself, you try not to feel, and so at the end, you don't feel very alive. And the third thing is that you continue to be hyper-aroused. You know, you just keep being bombarded, you keep overreacting to all kinds of things in general. That's the original definition of PTSD, and that is still the definition as you find in the textbook still, but what we discovered is that the whole impact of trauma is much larger, and it also affects the way you feel about yourself, the way you feel about other people, the way you are able to notice yourself, the way you experience yourself, and it has a lot of self-distortions and distortions of your body also. And then over time, we again rediscovered something, because these things always have been noted before, the degree to which when you're traumatized, your body keeps mobilizing itself to fight, and that you have all kind of immunological abnormalities, you have endocrine abnormalities, and that really devastates your health, your physical health, at the long range. Oftentimes the physical problems are longer lasting than the mental problems. The other thing that we discovered, which is still an area of some controversy in the field, not for me, but for my colleagues who are in power, is that trauma affects the mind and the brain very differently depending on the age at which you are. And so if something terrible happens to me right now, I have a whole well-developed brain, and my brain isn't really growing all that much anymore, so I'll get an imprint of the trauma that is pretty much superimposed on a relatively well-functioning brain. If you're 2, 3, or 4 years old, your mind and your brain is growing. What various of my research friends have shown is that trauma at different ages affects different ways of wiring the brain, and it gets very complex, as like my friend Marty Teicher has really shown that trauma at age 3 changes the brain very differently than trauma at age 5, and trauma at age 14, and that the brain keeps growing and evolving, and so different events have a different imprint on the brain. That's one aspect. And the other thing that is terribly important is not only what's happening to you, but what's happening to your environment. And by and large, as I said before, if you are really freaked out as a kid, and your parents are there for you, and they smile at you and say, I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it, honey. I know what to do. Or you have a doctor who really knows what they're doing, who you can trust. You go like, okay, I can relax now, because even if I can't take care of it, other people can take care of it for me. One of the largest mitigating factors against getting traumatized is who is there for you at that particular time. When you feel constantly threatened, of course, you don't trust anybody. But there is a reason to not trust people. The tradition in mental health is to dismiss people, the reality of people's lives. For example, it's only in the past few years that people are beginning to talk about the impact of poverty, or the impact of racism, or the impact of unemployment. And people have sort of been labeling people, oh, there's something wrong with you, let me fix you. But mental health professionals have been very defective in helping people to really come to terms with what actually has happened to them and what's happening to them right now. So a good amount of distrust is very well justified. And very likely today, if you're a traumatized person, You don't go to a doctor and say, I was raped when I was 4 years old, and that's why I come to be treated. No, people go come to be treated because today you blow up at your husband. And today you cannot have a safe, satisfactory sexual relationship with your new partner. And that's why people coming into treatment, because the body automatically reacts to certain stimuli. And most people actually are barely aware or not aware at all that their reactions that they're having right now are actually are rooted in experiences that they've had before. So if you go to a physician or a mental health practitioner who doesn't understand that, they're going to try to fix you with drugs or cognitive behavioral treatment to not do these crazy things anymore. It usually doesn't work very well because you need to really develop a deep sense of this is what happened to me. This is what I'm dealing with. And you need to really acknowledge like, oh my God, that was terrible what happened to me. And I need to take care of the wounds that I'm carrying inside of myself. This issue of self-compassion and really knowing that your reactions are understandable and are rooted in you getting stuck in the past is a terribly important part of beginning to recover from trauma. And as long as you ignore that, you're just a crazy person who has crazy reactions. The problem with trauma is that it starts off with something that happens to us or that's done to us. But that's not where it stops, because it changes your brain. And from now, that event itself is over, but you continue to react to things as if you're in danger. And your brain actually gets changed in a variety of different ways. And the problem then becomes that you are not able to engage or to learn or to see other people's point of view or to coordinate your feelings with your thinking. And so yet it becomes an internal issue how the trauma continues to fester inside of you in a variety of different sensations and perceptions. Yes, there is something wrong with you, but people don't come to see me because of what happened to them. People come to see me because they feel there is something really wrong with me. I cannot connect with my kids. I become angry with all my coworkers. Nobody can stand being around me because I am so reactive. Yes, trauma causes that there is something wrong with you. And my job as a psychiatrist and all the colleagues and students I have is to help you to feel safe in your body and to feel like the trauma is over and that you don't continue to react to all kind of things now as if somebody is trying to hit you or rape you. I think the most important thing to know is that there's a difference between trauma and stress. As I like to say to people, life sucks a good amount of the time. Now, we all have jobs and situations that are really unpleasant. But the moment that a situation is over, it's over. And you go on with your life. A trauma happens, and when it's over, your body continues to relive it. And the core issue is that your body does it. Your endocrine system, your neurohormonal system, the immunological system continues to react as if you're back there. So there is something about the development of the mind that gets stopped at that point because the trauma cannot be integrated as, oh yeah, that really sucked, but it's over now. Trauma makes you think that it's still happening right now. So the big challenge of treating trauma is how do we help people to live in bodies that feel fundamentally safe? Where something unpleasant happens to you, you don't react as if you're like, is in danger, but you go like, oh, how do I solve this? But when you're traumatized, what's very striking in a whole variety of different brain studies, what you show is that when you show a non-traumatized person something ambiguous and difficult, their cognitive brain tries to figure out what's going on. When you show this same stimulus to people who are traumatized, the emotional brain reacts like, is this dangerous or is this safe? Your brain goes into, is my life in danger? And that's an emotional reaction. What lights up in the brain is a very different part of the brain, but then when you have to solve a problem. So you're continuously trying to manage your emotional reactions.
Chapter 2, Shaping Childhood Trauma.
People have always noticed that people relive their trauma, but as I said before, usually people are not aware of it. Kids are not aware of that they're reliving their having been beaten or witnessing domestic violence, and when they go to school, they react in a very angry and defiant way with their teachers. Say, oh, this reminds me about my mom and dad fighting, making me scared. Now, they have an automatic reaction to adults who sound in any way not okay to blow up and become very frightened. So they don't make the connection. And so what happened when we created this diagnosis of PTSD, you know, we weren't very perceptive. You know, we were just beginning to see something for the first time. And the most obvious thing in which people relive the trauma is in nightmares. In nightmares, people see it again, or they experience the event in their dreams. That is the most obvious, and we could see it. It took us a long time to realize that people also are continue to reenact the trauma in their relationships, that they may relate to their kid the same way they related to people who hurt them as little children. And so they don't make that connection. But what allows you to make the connection is when you actually have images of what happened back there. But most people don't have visual images. Most people have sensory reactions, how they feel, suddenly feel uptight. They feel nervous, panicky, anxious, enraged. They don't know where it comes from. After they read books like mine, they know at least where it comes from. It comes from some part of your brain that you actually cannot really know because it's beyond cognition. So, oh, that's why I'm doing that stuff. That's sort of helpful to know. But most people who are reenacting or replaying the trauma are not aware that they're recreating or replaying the trauma. So trauma affects the developing brain different from a well-developed brain. The research is really very interesting, intriguing about this, and that's the degree to which parents hold and modulate kids' traumatic responses. As I said before, when as a kid you get bitten by a dog, it's really very scary and very nasty. But if your parents pick you up and say, oh, I'm so sorry, let's go and take care of it, and let's give you a bath, and we'll give you some extra special food, that dog bite doesn't become a big issue because the foundation of your safety has not been destroyed. A study I like to quote, actually, and teach people about is a study that was done in London right after the Second World War, because London was being bombed by the Nazis. The Brits decided, let's send the kids in London who are being bombed out to the bucolic English countryside to live with very nice people. And when the war is over, they'll come back and they won't have seen all these dead people and dead corpses and all the bombing. They'll be much better off. And so after the war, Anna Freud, of all people, Sigmund Freud's daughter, and her friend Dorothy Burlingame, did a study of what happened to these kids. It turned out that the kids who stayed in London with their parents did just fine, because the safety of kids is determined by how safe they feel with their parents. While the kids who went to the countryside, like Oliver Sacks, who some of your listeners may also be a great fan of like I am, he was shipped to the countryside, and in his autobiography, Oliver Sacks writes that one of the two most traumatic events in my life was being shipped off to the countryside, and I was a really scared and upset kid who was primarily preoccupied with whether my parents are still alive, but I didn't see them anymore. What trauma also has really taught us is the degree to which we are profoundly interconnected and interdependent people, and we are relational creatures. And as long as our relationships are intact, by and large, we're pretty good with trauma. Who knows that? The U.S. Marine Corps and the Armed Services, they take a bunch of people who are obviously who sometimes escape their own horrible child environments and join the military, and they go into the military. And what does the military do for them? They create a sense of cohesion, a sense of predictability, a sense of safety. And so through all these exercises that you do in the army, you feel very connected with your group. And when you go to war with your group, you feel very safe that your buddies are there to protect you, and that really protects you against getting traumatized. And the very first study I did, before we knew anything about trauma, was the discovery that the PTSD started for many soldiers when they saw their best friend being blown up. because they really had a sense of safety and cohesion because they had a friend. But then that friend got killed, the whole world collapsed, and they no longer had the safety that came with the group. And so what you see with many traumatized people is that they continue to really pull towards reconnecting with people who have had similar experiences, because when you say, I was raped and I was raped too, you go like, you know what I'm talking about. You're special. I can be safe with you, as opposed to all these people who have no idea what I'm talking about. The lingering effect of childhood trauma is that you continue to react to mild stressors as if your life is in danger. You tend to become hyperreactive. People see your reactions as exaggerated. Somebody may irritate you in the supermarket and may yell at this person. You may develop road rage. You may have a difficult time putting up with misbehavior from your spouse or your kids. And you have exaggerated emotional responses. The other thing is, it oftentimes is very hard to negotiate intimate relationships. Negotiating both of our needs, your needs and my needs, actually is a very complex phenomenon. How do we make compromises? How do we make both of us happy at the same time? And when you have a childhood trauma, that oftentimes becomes very difficult. Very difficult to say, okay, honey, if that's what you need, I wouldn't want to do that, but I'm fine with you if you do that. And these issues of boundaries and who's responsible for what becomes a very hard thing to negotiate oftentimes. The big question for me continues to be, how do you help kids in particular who have been exposed to enormous amount of violence, life threats, people who don't pay attention to them? How do you help these kids get a sense of self, a sense of agency, so they can actually make a life for themselves where they can learn, acquire skills, acquire competencies, so they become full-fledged human beings? What the data show is that the long-term effects of child abuse and neglect, which is rampant in our country, is the biggest public health issue in America. Let me give you an example. There's other societies that are much more trauma savvy than we are, where there is not an enormous amount of income inequality, where parents actually are helped to take care of their kids, where healthcare is universal, where childcare is universal. One of these places is Holland, which happens to be my native country, which I left when I was 18 years old, and which has become a very nice place. So in a culture like that, that really looks at what are the antecedents for getting people to be dysfunctional, they do all these things to help people to take care of their kids. And so in the Netherlands right now, the incarceration rate is 58 per 100,000 people. In the US, it's 950 per 100,000 people. So the big issue is a political issue. How do we rearrange our society to really know about trauma, and to really do all the things that are necessary so that people who grow up under extreme adverse conditions can develop a brain and a mind that can help them to become full-fledged members of society instead of on the edge as drug addicts and disabled people or people who need to go to jail. That's our big issue, and that's the big challenge that we have.
Chapter 3, How to Treat Trauma.
I was raised in the mainstream culture as a professor, prestigious institutions. And what's mainstream culture, the culture we live in, is that when you feel bad, you take a swig of alcohol or you take a swig of something to make that feeling go away. I call our medical culture right now a post-alcoholic culture, where if you feel bad, you take something to make that feeling go away. And it turned out that taking something didn't make the feelings go away, but wiggling your fingers in front of people's eyes as they think about the trauma made the trauma go away. And I go like, wow, this is really interesting. When I first got to see trauma and got intrigued with it, I looked at the treatments that we have. And so I did the first study on Prozac for PTSD, the first study for Zoloft for PTSD, and a number of other conventional drugs. What we found is that it didn't work very well. And we published this data in prestigious medical journals, and people said, boy, Wendell Koch is a great psychopharmacology researcher. But our results showed that they don't work very well. Somehow, psychiatry never got the message and said, no, drugs are not particularly helpful. And the VA still spends billions of dollars on drugs that don't work. They were unable to go through the trajectory that I and most of my colleagues went through, like, okay, if it doesn't work, let's do see what else can work. And people over ask me, how can you put up with all this misery that you hear? And I agree, it's not easy. But one of the things that helps you is to really understand that people do the best they can. That somebody who's enraged in response to a minor thing is not becoming enraged because they just are unpleasant, difficult people who don't try. No, they try. People try to survive. Every person tries to have the best possible life they can have. And sometimes it goes really wrong. But for example, when you're a little kid and you don't feel like anybody's there to help you when you become distressed, you may learn that banging your head against the wall or stabbing yourself or burning yourself or starving yourself may make you feel better. And so what you discover is that people do all kinds of things that seem pretty weird sometimes on the surface to protect themselves. There was a moment in sort of the history of our field that was particularly important in this regard. Vince Valletti, who is the internist who did the ACE study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences study, had a very important experience that he shared with all of us, which makes perfect sense to me. He had a weight loss program, and that's all he did. He was very proud of his weight loss program, and then one day a woman came to his office who had lost something like 150 pounds or something in the course of the weight loss program, and she came back 3 months later, and she had regained almost all of her weight. He said, I didn't know people could gain so much weight in such a short period. What happened to you? And she says, you know, Dr. Fillet, your weight loss program was terrific. And I became swelled, and people's reaction to me completely changed. So after my last visit to you, where you complimented me about how well I was doing, I went back to my office, and one of my coworkers said, boy, you look really hot. Would you like to go on a date tonight? And the moment he said that, I started to eat. And I haven't stopped eating, because what I realized is overweight is overlooked. And the way I dealt with my childhood sexual abuse is to make myself grossly obese so nobody would have an interest in me in a sexual way. So that was one of these openings. You get to see that some of the behaviors that we may condemn or be upset about actually are behaviors that start off trying to take care of yourself. That actually is also true for drug abuse. People, you know, people say it's a biological illness, but it's not so simple. But, you know, if I say to you right now, oh, I have a little needle with some heroin in it, makes you feel good, would you like to try it? You'd say, you're crazy. I'm not going to take heroin. But if you are in despair and you don't know if you're going to make it through the night, and I say, I have a little drug here that can help you make it through the night, you go like, please, please give it to me. That's where drug addiction comes from. That's also, to a large degree, where our opioid epidemic comes from. It's also the stuff being made available to people. But, you know, in among my colleagues who are, you know, have privileged lives, they don't become drug addicts because they have good lives. They don't need to cure something in terms of how upset they are. But since time immemorial, people take drugs in order to deal with unbearable sensations. The military had a huge drug problem during the Vietnam War because people take these drugs in order not to feel their pain. If we really want to take care of drug abuse, we really have to look at social situations and circumstances that make people feel desperate and hopeless. Very good psychotherapy, not to fix people, but helping people to know what they're feeling, find ways in which to cope with those feelings, was really quite helpful. But what's very clear is that being in a relationship where people can hear you, where you can talk about how badly you feel, but you can talk about your guilt, and where you can start opening up where these feelings come from, how old these feelings are, and how you develop these feelings in response to particular things that happened to you, that was actually quite helpful. Finding words for your internal experience, which is oftentimes very difficult for traumatized people. They actually have impairment of being able to know themselves, being able to discover who they are and how they got these reactions, is very helpful. And then for me, the opening to a new world came when some people in my clinic started to do something very strange, something called EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, a technique where you ask people to call up the memory of what you saw back then, what you heard back then, what you felt back then, but you don't ask people to talk about it. Because the moment you start talking about something, you get more preoccupied whether the person you're talking to understands you, likes you, is disgusted with you. So it becomes an interpersonal process. This, you ask people to just feel it and notice it. And then what you do is that you ask people to follow your fingers as you move your fingers from side to side in front of their eyes. And my first reaction with my students and junior colleagues who do it is like, man, stop this crazy nonsense. This is a crazy method. And then I got to see some of the results. I go like, wow, this is interesting. This is different. And so I did a study funded by NIH, funded because people saw me as a very good psychopharmacologist, not a guy who had gone off the deep end doing crazy methods like EMDR. And everybody expected that we'd find that the drugs are much better than EMDR. And what we found is that this crazy eye movement desensitization had amazing effects on people being able to let go of what happened and say, yes, that's what happened to me, and it happened a long time ago. It's not happening right now. That was the first time that I saw a non-conventional technique have a very profound effect. And that really had a very deep effect on my thinking about treatment of trauma. And of course, my colleague said, Bessel has gone off the deep end. The data on EMDR was still better than any data of the treatment outcome that anybody had studied, but people didn't want to go there because it's such a crazy method. So I tried to get money to study what those eye movements do to the brain. It took us about 15 years to collect money from other sources to finally do that study, where we were able to show that you move your eyes from side to side, that you actually change brain circuits, that changes the executive function of the brain, the default mode network of the brain, and the salience network of the brain. So what we discovered with all the other things that happened in neuroscience is that this strange eye movement that sounds so bizarre actually changes the circuitry of the brain to interpret your current reality from a different angle. But the discovery at this point is that our conventional way of thinking about it is not working, but strange stuff works. And then a bunch of yoga teachers come to talk to me and say, we do yoga for PTSD and it seems to help people. And that made sense to me on some level. Maybe if you do yoga, yoga can open up your relationship to your body, to your physical self. You learn how to breathe calmly. You learn to pay attention to yourself. You get to see how different movements and different postures affect you. And so you form a deep relationship to your internal sensory system. Trauma is carried in the sensations in your body, in heartbreak and gut wrench. And that we have been able to see in the brain is that your connection with your body becomes weaker and weaker, so you don't feel your body anymore, so you don't feel your pain anymore. Problem is that if you don't feel your pain anymore, you don't feel your pleasure anymore either. I was reading an extraordinary case report of somebody who lost all sensations in their skin, in their bodies. And it's a very, very rare thing to happen to people. And what people discovered is if you cannot have a sensation in your skin, you cannot have a sensation of pleasure. A sensation of pleasure is carried by the corpuscles in our skin. So we need to get pleasurable sensations coming from our body to get a sense of pleasure and joy. And that was really interesting to me also, because traumatized people, and that's left out of the definition, have a tremendous problem experiencing pleasure and joy. We applied a number of times to study that. And at the end, we did get funded to the very first yoga study for PTSD. And what turned out is that the way the data looked to me, yoga at the end was a more effective treatment for PTSD than any of the drugs we had studied. And we did a number of yoga studies. We published them in respected medical journals. But I've yet to see a psychopharmacology clinic being transformed to a yoga studio, even though it's pretty clear that needing to feel safe in your body and to own your body and to feel all the sensations in your body is a critical aspect of healing from PTSD. The next thing that we studied was theater and movement. And it turns out that playing different roles in your body helps you to feel that your body can feel differently depending on how you organize your relationship to yourself. So I live in the Berkshires, and we have a great program here called Shakespeare in the Courts, where if you're a juvenile delinquent in this county, you have a 50% chance that the judge will condemn you to become a Shakespearean actor. That's civilization. And the Shakespeare program is enormously helpful because it helps people to feel their bodies and to feel what it feels like to be a king and to feel like to be a warrior and to feel what it feels like to be Ophelia. And you get to really have a deep experience of yourself in different possibilities. We learned that you can actually put electrodes on your skull and you can harvest your brain waves and project them on a computer screen, and then you can program the computer screen so that when you make brainwaves that help you to be calm and focused, so the computer game is working. And if your brain makes waves that don't do that, there's no computer game. So your brain wants to play the computer game, but the moment you develop brainwaves that are not helpful to you, the screen goes blank. So that your brain sort of wants to do the right thing, and you can actually train people to make the right brainwaves. And that's another piece of research that I feel very proud of, because it's very hard to find funding for it, that we really showed that we can change people's brain and brain connections by playing computer brains games with your own brain, which is another important project that I'm working on and trying to implement in various communities. And also I did a study of foster care children who are extremely out of control kids who have no prognosis to probably ever function very well because they're just too disorganized and too hurt. And we did very well with neurofeedback to help to calm their brains down and to learn and to be in classrooms and to have friends. So there's all these things that at this point is still called alternatives that unless we go there, our patients continue to get stuck on not getting better. You have to keep looking. About 15 years ago, two guys came to talk to me, Rick Doblin and Michael Mithoffer, and they said, Bessel, you know a lot about trauma. What do you think about this idea? We are thinking about psychedelics. What do you think about psychedelics for trauma? And I go like, wow, that you're speaking from my heart. Because, of course, I'm a child of the 60s, and like everybody else who I know who grew up with me, we dabbled in LSD and psychedelic substances. I have a number of friends who are very well-known scientists, actually, and I have asked all of my friends, did you top acid as a college student also? And every one of my friends said, sure did. And I said, so how do you think it has affected your career? And every one of my friends says, you know, I think I've become the creative scientist that I am because I took these substances, because it allowed me to see that the reality that I was raised in, that the reality that I see, is a very small part overall reality that I is. Those sort of answers make me feel very curious, because one thing that all of us who know about trauma know is that when you get traumatized, you start living in a very narrow reality, the reality of the war in Iraq, the reality of your incest. That colors everything you do. And so you become intellectually and emotionally quite a constricted person, because you are always afraid to get hurt, and you still feel like, I'm about to get hurt again. So that becomes your world. I said to them, wouldn't it be great if we could do psychedelic substances to see if these substances can open up people's minds and to see that the reality that they live in is just a small part of the reality that there is. And then I said, don't do it. You're crazy. These drugs are illegal. I knew a whole bunch of people who did LSD and psilocybin research back when I was young. It helps me around a little bit, because I saw that revolution back then. I had Timothy Leary's office at Harvard for a period of time. I know what happened to all these guys. I said to Rick and Michael, don't do it. It will destroy your career. You'll never get permission. And they said, thank you very much for your opinion. We'll try it anyway. And they tried anyway. And through great challenges and lawsuits, etc., they got permission to do a study of MDMA for trauma. And it worked out pretty well. And they got permission to do a second study again. Very hard to do. And they did very well. And then Rick Doblin was able to collect a large amount of money, largely from Silicon Valley people, to do a very large and extremely expensive study of MDMA, also known as ecstasy or Molly. When that happened, they asked me if I wanted to be the principal investigator of one of the sites in Boston. And I said, boy, I admire you so much for having been able to get a study off the ground. I would love to see what it does. But the main reason why I want to be involved in the study is to warn people not to get carried away, because last time people got carried away and the whole world collapsed. And this time we need to be extremely careful, so that if we find something, we do it very carefully and we don't get the backlash. We did the study. Lots of different sites around the US, one in Israel, one in Canada. We saw remarkable results. The paper was published in Nature Medicine, a very prestigious medical journal, that shows that the MDMA causes a very, very substantial drop in PTSD, probably more than just about anything else we have studied, although I'm not 100% sure of that, but very dramatic. And then what comes up for me is, yeah, you know, the PTSD score is interesting, but what we see in the people we work with is much more profound than just PTSD. So let me tell you how the study is set up. People apply to be in the study. It's a very tough study to be in. It takes about 9 months to do it. You come in, you get tested up the wazoo, you go off all your medications, you do a lot of tests, you have a number of preparatory sessions, and then finally, after all the preparation, you have a whole day of taking ecstasy while you lie on the bed, the eye shade, the two therapists in your room for 8 hours, and then stuff happens, which I'll talk about in a second. You sort of calm down from the experience. You stay overnight. The next day, we interview people again. We interview people several times in between. You have your next experience. A month later, number of sessions in between, and you have your next experience again. It's not surprising that our control group, where people get an inactive substance, also do very well, because people get very intensive psychotherapy alongside of the drug. So half people get the drug, half people don't get the drug. But what we see in the people who get the drug is amazing. What we see is that people are able to go to places they've never felt safe to go to. This is not a picnic. People go and see their rape. They see their molestation. They see the horrible things that happen to them. But what MDMA does, it allows people to see themselves with compassion. And rather than blaming themselves or getting freaked out, they go like, oh yeah, that's what happened to me back then. It was horrible. But what we see is a profound transformation of the personality, not just PTSD. And so I was very lucky that the organization asked me to analyze what is called the secondary data, which I'm doing right now. And the secondary data are, wow, they're just manna for my soul. This is like, because it brings the mind back into psychiatry. After people take MDMA, they're able to talk about themselves. They're able to have compassion for themselves. They're much better able to say, this is what's going on with me. And so all these measures we have about self-perception and self-awareness just shoot up, and people become owners of their own lives. And they're able to say, yes, this is what happened to me, but it's over. And then we look at the whole issue of executive functioning, being able to make plans, being able to attune to other people, being able to be feel alive. Big changes. People could come to life. And when people are in difficult relationships, they say, honey, that's your problem. That's not my problem. And people sometimes leave abusive relationship and they say, I don't need this abusive relationship. I'm okay. I can take care of myself. And you see very profound existential transformations in people. And I think that's really at the end holds the promise that people can leave the trauma behind and not say, I'm a veteran who still screwed up. Yes, I was a veteran back then. I was 18 years old. But today I'm 23 years old or 48 years old or 60. And I'm a plumber, an electrician, a movie maker, whatever. And that's part of my experience. But it doesn't define who I am anymore. It's remarkable.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to do.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
All right, we're riding around that self-pity, and we are getting rid of it, and we're leaving it behind, you know, because it's the disease. I was having a conversation with Tate Matthias, and Tate Matthias was telling me about it is the disease of the soul, and I fully agree. So, ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, we are diving. We're diving into our little hearts. We're diving into our little problems. We're diving into the world of catastrophe, because we can, and we will do so in style, in a true matriarchal way, because I mean, what do we have to lose except to gain knowledge?
Let's say that someone has never been exposed to your ideas in The Body Keeps the Score. How do you introduce your thesis?
How do I introduce my things? I usually show movies, actually Hollywood movies, because, you know, when you make a movie, you have to show it correctly. When you see somebody getting stuck and somebody being traumatized, like scenes from The Hurt Locker or other movies about veterans coming home or about kids who have been molested, usually movies capture it pretty well. You can really see how the way that people move and people hold their bodies and how people's bodies react to the world around them is very visible, actually.
Yeah. Right. So you're trying to demonstrate an outward exposure in terms of how the body looks of an internal emotional state.
Yeah, so we can beat each other. We look at each other and hopefully you look pretty calm, and when I see you getting upset or something, I'll go, oh, I'm saying something is upsetting him. And so we give signals to each other. And of course, as a body-oriented therapist, you get pretty good in reading bodily signals, yeah.
So that everybody understands, they see someone that stands in a particular way, has a facial expression in a particular way, is holding themselves. That doesn't sound that surprising. If that's the case, why is the traditional way that we try to think about trauma wrong? What does the traditional paradigm get wrong?
It is interesting indeed that it's so obvious. And I actually have gotten, you know, my bookstore sold 5 million copies. I've hardly had any blowback of people say that I'm getting it wrong. I mean, it's really obvious. But, you know, we come from a world of medicine where we try to define things very carefully. Medicine, of course, is a very disembodied profession. We deal with the body, but we really don't know about the body. And psychology is about the minds and how people think and about the behavior. But psychology is has also traditionally been a very disembodied profession. And the people who, to my mind, really get it are theater directors, teachers, yoga instructors, martial arts people, musicians, because in the real world, you really get to see how bodies really move together through the world. Yeah.
What is the difference between trauma and stress, then?
Stress is what it's like to be human. We're wired for stress. We're wired to rise to the occasion. We're wired to have hard days and broken relationships. And, you know, life is rough for all of us in one form or another. But when that stress is over, you can like, wow, I'm feeling better now. And the issue is trauma is that trauma is an assault on one's being that really changes the way you feel, experience yourself, how you experience the world about you. And so trauma really changes the way you move through the world and who you are. And so stress is a temporary thing. We have great biology of stress, and there's basically nothing wrong with stress. That's how we have come as far as we have as human beings. But trauma gets you stuck and frozen in that particular spot of being enraged or fearful or terrified or something like that. Yeah.
Is there a link between trauma and chronic stress? Is that just another word for the same thing?
Yeah, you know, it gets difficult. You know, like chronic stress, if you work on a project, if you're in the military, can actually be quite enjoyable in a way because you feel that all your capacities are being used. You see this after disasters, that people who work on cleaning up disasters tend to feel very close to the people who they have gone through the experience with. Gives them a sense of intimacy also. But the big issue that is being left out in most psychology texts and most people's conceptualizations is that we are social creatures. And we don't exist by ourselves. We don't, and we're always thinking about other people. We're defining ourselves through who we belong to, what ethnic group we belong to, our religions, our neighborhoods, etc., etc. So we are social species. And in trauma, usually those connections with other people break down. The very first study I did on Vietnam veterans, what we found is that they actually were doing quite well during the war, but what if one of their best friends got killed? That really was what blew them up and disintegrated. It was really the loss of that social connection that really made something traumatic. We saw this again in studies after 9/11 in New York, and that, you know, it's a horrendous event, and all of us who are old enough to remember it, most of us still are, really remember very vividly what happened at the time, but very few people got PTSD because there was such an enormous amount of social support and nobody blamed anybody. And then it turned out that the people PTSD were the people who were in domestic violent relationships or who do not feel home, safe at home, actually.
That's interesting.
So being able to go home at night and feel safe in your own home with the people you're with is a very powerful protection against getting messed up by outside events.
Yeah, the role of casting off the stress. You know, my favorite example of this is if anyone that's listening has an intense phone call, they're on the phone to somebody and they, it's a difficult work call or they're really trying to think things out, but it's audio only. They're not on Zoom. You'll find yourself like a puppet master has gotten a hold of you and made you stand up from your seat and you'll find yourself walking around the room.
Yeah. But
why?
If you have somebody who you trust and care for who's in the next room, you tell them, honey, listen to what just happened to me, what this asshole did to me. And but your honey says, boy, I don't know how you can stand that when the person backs you up. You feel much better inside. But if your honey says, well, I'm not surprised he said that to you because I see the same stupid thing that you do all the time and he's absolutely right in the way he talks to you, then it really becomes a much more invasive issue. And so the social reception makes a huge difference.
Why would it be the case? Can you think of an adaptive reason or an explanation for why individuals going through trauma would shield themselves from other people around them, given that people around them are exactly the thing they need to improve their relationship to that emotional state?
That's because they have learned that the people around them at some points could not be trusted. That the people who were closer to them hurt them or push them away or they must do with them or criticize them all the time. And so, you know, it is really what you learn during your trauma is that I thought I could trust people, but I can't. I trust that people will be there for me, but I can't. And that becomes, so you get very suspicious about people reaching out to you because you have had experiences that people do terrible things to you. And so that may get, become part of your roof and warp of your brain, actually. Yeah.
Mm. What's your definition of trauma? Is it an event which occurs outside the bounds of normal human experience?
No, that. Oh, we started off and it was a crazy definition because, you know, the majority of people have had trauma in their lives. You know, I keep looking for people who come from a perfectly normal family, and I still have a hard time finding them, actually. We all have major challenges. And so, you know, my organization, the Trauma Research Foundation, just is putting out a statement right now, and we're still really wrestling with the idea, how do you define trauma? And the trauma is really that you get hurt by something, and you get changed by it. But that something may be any variety of things. It may be a rape, yeah, very clear. It may be seeing your kid being run over or killed, that's very clear. But sometimes it's just being chronically ignored and dismissed. That eventually really gets into you, and that becomes part of your framework of who you see the world. Yeah.
When it comes to the body keeping the score, what do you mean? How does the body actually register this? What is the mechanism? How does it manifest?
The brain registers it, but your body experiences it and your body lives it out. So what happens is that you don't remember the trauma so much as you continue to react as if you're being traumatized. So let's say you have been sexually assaulted. And you go on with your life, you say, oh, it was just one incident, I'm really stupid for getting involved in it, and it's not happening. And then you get excited about somebody who you want to be with, and then that person touches you, and your body freezes. Or you start crying, or you become really angry. And your body reacts as if you're getting assaulted. You don't make that connection, say, oh, I really like this guy, and I'd like to be involved with him, but my memory of the trauma interferes. Now, it's an automatic mind process that gets in the way of your letting go at that point.
Yeah, you say that trauma robs you of the feeling that you are in charge of yourself.
That's
a harrowing but accurate statement, I think.
Yeah. And so, you know, people defend themselves against that and say, oh, it is because he did something wrong or because he talked to me the wrong way. Or, but at the end, I just writing our new book, finished last chapter of our new book, and I started with a quote from Marcel Proust. In order to change, you need to see the world with new eyes. So at the end, if you really want to recover from trauma, We need to help people to change their perceptions of the world. We're not going to change the world out there, but we're going to change what they see and how they experience themselves and the people around them.
Well, ultimately, we are not in control of what is going to happen to us in life. We really only have control over our reactions.
Well, we don't even have control of our reactions. At some point, you need to go to the bathroom. At some point, you need to not hold your breath. At some point, you need to go to sleep. Some people will make you angry, and other people will make you feel all warm inside. And you don't have much control over your reactions. You have some control over how you behave. And that's really the difference between little kids and adults. Little kids do whatever happens to them, and they react to it. As adults, we get the prefrontal cortex, and hopefully most of the time we can make decisions about how we react, even though our bodies tell us, don't trust this guy. You can still talk to that person as if you trust him. You know, you can't.
This is something I really want to dig into, and I think a lot of people listening will resonate with this. They are thoughtful, inquisitive, reflective people. They like their cerebral horsepower and their cognitive ability. They understand that something can occur and they can control their behavior. And yet at the same time, that they have a degree of control over their behavior, even if they don't have a degree of control over their reaction and the way it makes them feel. At the same time, we also need to be aware and give respect and integrate and become noticing of the emotions that arise inside of us. And I can see a degree of tension between these two things. The person that wants to feel like they're in control of their life and has agency, the person who also wants to appreciate and integrate the signals that their body is giving them, but not be at the mercy of them. How do you think about the tension between these things?
What terms that people oftentimes discover is how little control they have. And in some ways, the people who become my patients are among the most conscious people you ever hope to meet, because they're willing to explore themselves. And most people are not so eager to do that. They want to stick with their habits in life and push away anybody who interferes with their usual habits. And the people who come to my office say, I cannot stand what's happening inside of me anymore, and I need to become in charge more of my own reactions. And so therapy actually is a very courageous act of confronting your internal demons and confronting the pain and hurt of your life, actually.
So it seems to me that when we're talking about trauma, people have a reaction to an event which typically would not engender that reaction. They are trauma sensitive. They are overly reactive in a scenario that maybe doesn't warrant it because of something which they have learned in their past. Is that a correct framing?
I wouldn't say learned. Something has been installed in them from the past. And these are not higher level cognitive processes. Are elementary activities that have to do with the area of the brain involved in the housekeeping of the body, as Antonio Damasio calls it.
What is that from a neuroscientific sense?
Oh, it is your ventral tegmental area, your amygdala, your periaqueductal gray, the precuneus. It's a back part of your brain that we have in common with all animals that help us to perceive what's happening to us on an elementary level, the same way that your dog hears a thunderstorm and crawls underneath the couch. We have the same brain as the dogs have, and on top of that, we have a big frontal lobe that hopefully makes us slightly more capable of managing our emotions than dogs do. But many people don't.
I've met many people who don't have any more emotional control than dogs do. And I think that tension between wanting to feel like the architects of our own life and understanding that we have a limbic system, which very much is the elephant that we sit on top of. And it's not the elephant that's got blinders on. It's us, the rider, but we have this belief that we're the one that's in control. I think that tension is where, some people are probably resistant to ideas like this because it feels disempowering. It feels like there is an architect pulling their strings.
Well, yes and no. You know, with any sort of self-reflection, we all know that. we all are aware of that in a way. There may be some people who don't want to go there, but they're not very simply.
I understand that may not be the truth, but I think that it explains, at least to me, you know, I don't like the idea that I'm not in charge. I don't, and I will find ways to resist that belief. Even if I know that it's true, I try and sort of finagle and find ways to go through things. So I guess one of the, you mentioned it earlier on, different people reacting to the same event will react in different ways. Some people will be traumatized and others won't be.
People make a big deal out of that. You know, having the practice that I do, running the center that I have for 50 years, I never meet somebody who has been traumatized by it. I go like, boy, that's a pretty silly thing to get traumatized by. Usually if you dig deeper to what people have been exposed to, you go like, my God, and you're still here. You're still able to tell the story. It is not like, oh, something happens and everybody else is fine and you got traumatized by it. Usually, if you really look at the details of what happens, you see that it really was a very painful experience. And my reaction almost invariably, hearing the story about the people I work with, what they have gone through, is like, oh, my God, how the hell did you survive? And I never have the feeling that, oh, I would have done much better than they did.
Mm-hmm. This is something else I really wanted to dig into, which is the minimization and the shame that people feel around them not having anything worthy of being labeled as that was when I was a child. Oh, you know, it was just one time. Oh, it was whatever. Talk to me about that. Talk to me how that can hide in the dark some of the things we've experienced.
You know, we all want to be normal. You know, one thing came up in the last few days is how almost everybody wants to tell other people, I came from a very happy family. And you don't really want to know that your father was a drunk and your mom spent half her time in bed and stuff like that. And so we want to be normal. We want to be acceptable. And so we make a construct of ourselves of people who are in charge of ourselves and who have always been loved by the people we're close to. But that is how we like to experience ourselves. It's not very true, but, you know, we like to look good to the world.
Yeah. You know, no one wants to admit just how insane they are, I think. And there's two layers to this that I was thinking about when looking at your work. The first one being the minimization and the shame that we have around situations that have happened to us in the past. And the second one being the shame around being triggered by seemingly small events in the present.
Yeah. Yeah. And you say to yourself, don't be stupid. You become very judgmental about yourself and very ashamed about your own reactions.
Uh-huh.
When you're ashamed, you don't want anybody to see you for who you are. Yeah.
It's the story that we tell ourselves
about
our reactions that seems to be the really unnecessary degree of suffering that we've laid on top of all of this.
Yeah, you know, it's a way of coping. And so dismissing things is a very good initial reaction. Like, I want to go on with my life and push it behind me.
I don't want this to define me.
It's a healthy thing to do. And for a while, it oftentimes helps many people until you have a kid or you are in a relationship or something that really comes closer to what happened to you. And then you start feeling the old feelings and having the old reactions again. And you go like, what the hell is wrong with me? You usually start with, what the hell is wrong with this person who I'm hooked up with? You usually blame it on the other person.
Mm-hmm.
And after a while, if you've seen that one relationship after another ends up the same way, you go like, maybe it's something to do with me. But that's not the automatic reaction. The automatic reaction is, it's because you are...
Well, yeah, there's a quote, if all of your exes are assholes, it might not be them that's the asshole. You are the common denominator between all of your exes.
That's a good summary of it.
One of the things I've been thinking is whether experiencing traumatic events and having trauma sensitivity predisposes us to being more sensitive to future traumas. Does this become a recursive loop in that way?
Oh, absolutely. Generally, you know, it's also true that some people who have been traumatized become very good at stuff. So let's look at the positive thing first. I have met a number of nurses or kindergarten teachers who are spectacular nurses, spectacular kindergarten teachers, because they were traumatized as kids and they know what they would have needed back then. And so they give to people what they felt they didn't get themselves as kids. That is one adaptation that happens sometimes. But more often, people are out of touch and repeat their trauma early on. But I meet quite a lot of people where deep down I think to myself, I don't say it because most people don't have enough sense of humor about it. Say, go back and thank your abusive parents for having been abusive because it made you very good how to take care of dysfunctional people around you.
Mm. Well, I suppose if every trauma made you more susceptible to future traumas, you would just have a linear graph over time of people getting more and more traumatized as they get into older age. They would just continue to accumulate and continue to get sensitive and continue to be accumulate and continue to get sensitive.
Yeah, that's of course not how it goes.
Yep.
Because people also have lives, and some people are able to arrange to have lives that are more or less predictable and where they can play a useful role and where they shield themselves against unpleasant surprises, more or less. Easier to do when you're a somewhat privileged person, harder to do when you're poor and brown, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that we can do during difficult events to minimize the way that they imprint on us?
You know, my agenda, I'd like to say as often as I can, is that in every school from K through 12, we should have weekly classes and laboratories on understanding ourselves, to learn about how our brain functions, how our body functions, what happens to us when somebody touches us, what happens when we throw a ball, what happens when you make music together, what happens when you interact with people. And that, to my mind, a very important part of the solution is teaching every kid from the beginning of classes the four R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, and self-regulation, and make yourself an important part of the study that we do. And I think our society would change if all of us would learn that systematically, that we learn about brains and neuroscience and how brains interact with each other and experience what it's like to play ball with other people, to be involved in rhythmical activities. What does music do for me? What does things like these crazy Qigong movements do for me? What does it like, is it like for me to sing with other people? How do I affect other people? All this stuff should be part of our basic training, as it oftentimes, okay, of course, is for many privileged people who actually go to schools where and live in households where people learn stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, I understand that self-regulation is a great tool for dealing with and making yourself feel better.
Yeah, but also understanding yourself, really knowing, oh, when I get upset, listening to that piece of music makes me feel better. Or I found that when I sit in front of a piano and play some music, that I calm myself down.
Mm.
If somebody, if I can play volleyball with somebody, and to really that, in your course of your education and your growing up, you really learn what makes you feel good and what can you do for yourself when somebody upsets you.
Yeah. So, yeah. I'm really trying to work out how much of that, I really want you to dig into, is that an ability to simply cope with the emotions that come up, or is it something which will reduce down the echo that it continues in the future, or is that one and the same?
No, what I'm talking about really is that we raise conscious human beings
who are really aware of themselves, aware of their own reactions, who are aware of the people around them and what effect they have on other people. And that this really becomes a serious area of study to live in a more conscious society.
How can people learn to be more self-compassionate? We live in a meritocracy. People want to achieve things. They want to grow and improve. And yet a lot of this seems to rely on self-compassion. What's your advice?
You know, self-compassion really comes from having been met and having been seen. And that becomes your framework of yourself. And so if you come from indeed a loving, kind, and responsive family, it's likely that you do feel self-compassionate. And that when you learn that when I fall down, somebody will be there to pick me up. People don't yell at me and scream at me for falling down, but they're really there for me in a way. That's how you learn to be there for yourself also. Huh? A huge thing that we see in our work is having a history of abuse and neglect early on in your life really more or less guarantees that you see yourself as defective and wrong and not a good person and disgusting and sort of stuff. An extremely difficult thing to treat. The first thing that I've actually seen work for that was the research of which I was the PI on psychedelics, MDMA, where we saw that psychedelics really dramatically increased people's capacity for self-compassion, where they really were able in the psychedelic states to go to whatever happened to them and to really feel very deeply what happened back then and to go, yeah, that's what happened to this kid. This kid was only 3 years old and did the best he could. Or he's only 8, or he didn't know how to deal with his bullies in high school, and he felt so weak and stupid, but that's all he could do. And so on psychedelics, you really, MDMA particularly, we see this emergence of this capacity to really accept yourself for what has happened to you and not blame yourself for things. And I've never seen it to the same degree with any other form of treatment I've studied.
That's really beautiful. To think about the person that you were when that thing happened to you and to say something like, you did your best. You know, you want to pick that person up and give them a hug.
But it's not cognitive. It's not like your frontal lobe. It's really, in psychedelics, you really deeply experience yourself on a very deep level. And it's not an outside person telling you it wasn't your fault. You're just, you never believe that really. But it's yourself really feeling what happened to you and getting an internal sense of time so you don't no longer identify with that kid who was being bullied or he was being put down or whatever. You say, oh, I'm so sorry that I, back then, had to go through that.
You say that we shouldn't keep secrets from ourselves, and it seems to me that what we're doing with psychedelics also breathwork practices in some ways, anything that allows you to sort of both dysregulate and regulate a little bit under control and make yourself feel safe to tap into these things. It breaks down the secret wall that we are able to construct around those things. Ah, this doesn't feel safe. I can't think about that thing. I don't want to go back to that place. And it helps you to sink into that more.
Yeah. And to my mind, this is becoming a very urgent social issue. I don't know whether you have heard or seen the new book by Jonathan Haidt.
He was on the show a couple of weeks ago.
It's a very important book that we are raising our kids behind screens and not to explore and not to feel things. And we give kids a false reward system by screens where they don't have to do anything. And I think screens will have a major negative effect on self-knowledge and self-experience, actually. And I think we really need to listen very carefully what Jonathan has to say about that. Yeah.
Digital anesthetic is one of the ways that I think about it. People who are going through something emotionally uncomfortable can distract themselves with their screens.
Yeah.
That results in you basically not connecting with your life. the emotions.
You know, it's not black or white, of course. It's okay to distract yourself. It's okay to not confront all the misery of the world all the time. So I totally understand that and actually encourage it that when something bad happens to people, they could do something else to not dwell on it. And there's actually another very important research, piece of research that's just beginning to make it into our consciousness by Farb and Sindel Siegel about how your sensory experiences, your feeling things, your senses, and doing things that make you alive to your senses help you to get out of habitual ways of doing things. For example, I did the first study on yoga for trauma, and we had amazingly positive results. And now with the evolution of neuroscience, I'm beginning to understand more and more why yoga can be so effective, because in yoga, you really pay attention to the internal sensory world. And that seems to be a very important avenue for you to feel that you can meet yourself and be in control of yourself.
Say more about that. Why is that so important? What is it about the attention being deployed?
Because we all get into habits. Our brain creates habitual system. So basically the brain is a predictive organ. The brain tells us when I talk to you in Austin, Texas, I can expect certain things. And if you do something that is very different from what I expect, I have to sort of change my take on you. But ordinarily, I go into a habit of doing the same thing and talking the same thing. But if your habits no longer work for you, you always blow up at your kids, or you always freeze in front of your boss, you need to get a new habit. And the new habits get formed by activating the sensory system in your brain. It's the opposite of what you do with screens. You dull your sensory system in your brain with screens by doing action, meditation, yoga, probably martial arts, stuff like that. You really activate new habits.
Talk to me. There'll be a lot of people listening and go, okay, Bessel, that sounds spot on. That makes sense to me. I understand how our emotions and our reactivity can become hypersensitized. But this goes quite a few steps further. How does trauma manifest as an illness, an illness that people would typically recognize? What are the ways that can happen?
Well, you know, of course, I'm an MD and a professor in medical school, so I know the medical model, but in our work, I don't have a medical model, not your disease and you aren't. You know, a lot of people who have never been to a psychiatrist are crazy as loons, and people who are been to psychiatrists are some of the most sensible people I know. So pathology is when you miss the boat, right? When you keep doing things that mess up your life and the life of people around you. That's the pathology. So you wouldn't necessarily give it a psychiatric label, but all somebody's friends will say, they're doing it again. You know?
Yeah. Talk to me about some of the more typical illnesses that people would not think stress and trauma in this way contribute to, and yet can. Stuff like fibromyalgia.
These are questions that should be asked more often, in part because we have so few answers at this point. Is that it's very clear that fibromyalgia, chronic pain, autoimmune diseases. I'm not saying that autoimmune diseases are caused by trauma, but they certainly are made much worse by trauma. It makes you much more vulnerable to develop them. All these somatic responses have been identified, but barely studied and barely really systematically looked at what can you do and how can you best take care of it. But they're clearly trauma-related. And they're clearly body related. But because there is so little attention in the research world on how we process bodily experiences, that this is very largely still an unknown territory. And my foundations I started, the Trauma Research Foundation, actually is particularly interested in
promoting studies on these sort of things that have not been studied or funded before.
It seems interesting to me, or totally unsurprising, that chronic, elevated concern and worry and inflammation in the mind and the body would not make, how could it make anything better? I don't understand why that wouldn't be something which is a contributing factor.
It clearly is, but I think our academic work is not there to really systematically explore body sensations and how to change people's relationship to their bodily experience.
Well, I suppose that testing that is very difficult. You know, here is a dose of a drug. We gave this many people in this cohort that dose for this long. These are the results. These are the self-reports. For you to say, Chris, how does your body describe to me the sensation? What's the inner texture of your mind like today?
Yeah. But, you know, you can study it if you put your mind to studying it. You know, like at the beginning, you don't have vocabulary for it. You don't know how to do it, but you learn how to do it. For example, the very first study that we funded from our foundation is a study on the impact of touch and various forms of touch on a group of people who have no trauma and a group of people who have been traumatized. You know, to me, it's just fascinating that people have studied eyesight. People have won Nobel Prizes studying vision. People have won Nobel Prizes in audition. But touch has barely been studied. That's very interesting.
What did you find?
Oh, we're still in the middle of the study. Actually, we're funding it. And next week, I hope to hear the first report on what they're finding.
Hell yeah. Okay. So when it comes to modalities and getting better, both dealing with in the moment and unwinding the broader patterns, what are the principles? Is there a framework? What is it that people need to focus on when it comes to treating trauma?
Well, the main focus is when you're traumatized, you lose your core sense of safety and internal integrity. And so the greatest challenge is how you induce a sense of total safety in the organism that a person lives in. And certainly, judging by my own experience and many other people since the time, having body work done in you, working with yoga, tai chi, qigong, everything that activates your relationship to your own body is sort of step number one. Sitting in a hot tub, being able to be touched, being able to just sort of let go, is the first step to shut down an alarm system that's always active. Yeah.
Presumably, if that isn't shut down, no further work can be done.
That is my sense. Yeah. And what is also very striking, actually, is that up to now, basically all of our treatments didn't work all that well with very shut down people. And one of the surprising findings of our MDMA study was that very shut down people actually came to life on MDMA. Just like, wow.
Why would you think, what could you hypothesize would be the reason for that?
What we hypothesize is that the MDMA changes people's awareness of themselves. You know, we can talk, do some what I call biobabble. We can talk about the serotonin receptors in the brain. You'll say, oh, he must be very smart. He knows about serotonin receptors. But it doesn't really explain anything. Now I have some words to use to explain it. The brain is an incredibly complex organ, but we're beginning to get some little understanding about what might be going on to make that happen.
Okay, so that's step one.
Yeah.
What does step two look like?
Step two is to be able to feel what you feel and to really be, you know, that's what, for example, mindfulness practices have been good for it's not as hot a topic as it was a few years ago, but mindfulness is very big. And, what is also true is that doing mindfulness exercise, doing meditation can be very stressful because as you
shut down all external input, you feel yourself. And feeling yourself can be a very scary and unpleasant experience, actually, which a lot of people don't want to do. So they turn on the TV and they have a lot of input in order not to feel themselves. But if you cannot live in silence with yourself, you're not okay. And that's what you see with soldiers who come back from Iraq and Afghanistan. First thing they do, they turn up the volume, they make a lot of noise, they don't want to feel what's inside of them, they just want to go, all that stuff out there. And that's because they're scared of themselves. And so learning how to, and most of us need guides for that, somebody who encourages us to do it and has with us to say, well, I know it's difficult, but I'll help you to meet yourself. And that's a really important thing.
It's a common realization of mine that on the days when I haven't allowed my mind to talk to me during the day, it usually comes back and gets its revenge when I'm trying to go to sleep on a nighttime.
It's interesting how it is going to evolve. I see things sort of going up and down. It depends very much on the environment you live in. When I go to the Bay Area, I see a lot of people doing the sort of things I'm talking about. There seems to be some consciousness about it. Maybe Austin, Texas, maybe another place. It's very sort of geographically happening in different places at different times.
Yeah, you've got an odd sort of domain-centric trickle-down effect. And the UK, as is tradition, will be last to do it.
But I know some very, very mindful UK.
I know some mindful people too. It's a slow adoption state, though. Apparently the Atlantic is a little bit bigger to get health and wellness things to go across it.
Well, it's interesting how, in many ways, I just came back from 2 months in Australia. I think Australia is, I met some Australians who said, I said, you know, Australia is so much like America. We're just slightly more screwed up in the US. Slightly. it's interesting. A friend of mine just wrote to me, said, can you help this friend of mine who's writing about all the trauma in America? And I said, well, I'll talk to him, but he also should talk about the enormous creativity and the innovation that continues to come out of our culture. And maybe the two of them are two sides of the same coin. And it's interesting. I go to Europe quite a bit also. Standard of living is great in Europe. I think standard of life is great, but they're not quite as sharp and innovative as America is. I think our world being as unpredictable and oftentimes scary does keep us on edge a little bit here in the US. Again, the same theme as we talked about before. If you're privileged, it's a great place to be creative, but if you're downtrodden, it's a
I love Italy. Rome is my favorite city on the planet. And I'll never forget the first time that I went from Leonardo da Vinci Airport to the center of Rome on the metro. Yeah. And it was 2 p.m., something like that. There was an Icelandic girl that I was going on holiday with. And she was going to be an hour's time. And I was like, I'm in Rome. I'm getting an espresso and I'm going to sit outside and eat a croissant. So sure enough, I find a local cafe and this dude comes in a business suit, no tie, and it's 2 o'clock. And I presume that this must be his lunch break. And I saw him spend probably 35 to 40 minutes of what I'm going to guess is maybe a 50 or hour long lunch break, just with a large glass of red wine, sat outside, just sipping it. Some people were coming in and out. Maybe he was a local. He sort of had a little chat to them. And, that culture does not engender the permanent ambient anxiety and vigilance of spurning creativity that you would have in the caffeine-fueled Americas.
Yep. But as you sort of imply, his life is slightly better.
Pretty enjoyable. Pretty enjoyable lunch break. Okay, so we've allowed ourselves to feel safe.
But you know, learning how to be, I mean, for many people, that's a major enterprise, actually, to discover what makes them feel safe, actually.
Situations that make me feel safe. These are the modalities that work for me.
Yeah, the experiences. I always call it a journey. It's always a pilgrimage to find out what works for you. For example, I really I'm very fond of body workers and people who are very good massage people. Very good to learn that it's safe to be touched. They get comfort out of touch. Yeah. But sometimes for some people, music does it. For some people do being part of a volleyball game or being part of a dojo with martial arts, makes them feel good. So you need to really discover, it's an enterprise for yourself. It's important to know that about yourself. Yeah. Yeah.
And after we've started to feel into those emotions, yeah. Step two, we've sat with that. What comes after that?
Comes after that. So what comes up that keeps getting in the way? And then you need to really explore what gets in the way and begin to talk and have language for yourself and say, no, whenever I meet a person like that, I get really upset. Or whenever Christmas comes along, I get really depressed and I really don't want to go home. Or I go home, but I feel always depressed afterwards. I wonder what that's about. I need to ask questions of yourself and what has informed your personality to be the way it has become. Yeah.
Does having the understanding reduce the power of that response? I'm just thinking, when Christmas comes around, I feel uncomfortable to go home. That's because throughout my childhood, I didn't feel that safe at Christmas, and there was always this competition between me and my brother or whatever, whatever. I'm wondering what the final step to close this loop is.
It's not the final step. I think knowing why you're screwed up does not necessarily make you less screwed up. But it does give you choices. Like if you really remember what Christmas were like and you allow yourself to remember it, because we prefer to think, oh, we all come from very happy families and let me show you pretty pictures of Christmas bunnies or whatever, you know, like, and you go like, no, it wasn't so great. You can go, maybe this year I should not go home for Christmas. Maybe this year I'll go to Mexico for Christmas. So you start being able to make choices, but it doesn't abolish it. And I think, what abolishes it is certain techniques that allow you to go deep down there. The technique used to be hypnosis for 100 years. Hypnosis has sort of been wiped off the map. Nobody's doing it anymore. I'm sure it will come back because being in a trance is very important with you, because you need to get out of your ordinary consciousness to be able to observe things in a somewhat dispassionate way. Something like EMDR can get you there, a variety of other techniques. And again, on psychedelics also, you can really alter your perspective on things. And you need to have experiences. So once you have a language, you can create experiences for yourself that are different. So you can say, maybe this year I will not be spent Christmas with my older brother until he and I have a conversation about what really happens between us.
Mm-hmm. Mm. One of my favorite quotes is from Kenpi Rinpoche, and he says, ultimately in life, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of our mental afflictions and the discomfort of becoming ruled by them.
I rented an office in Harvard Square. It's my first office after I finished my training. And the bathroom wall, a patient had written, live with the sadness of your limitations or the pain of your transgressions.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Live with the sadness of your limitations or the pain of your transgressions. Just because we're throwing quotes at each other, one other one from last year that stopped me in my tracks, from Neil Strauss, the guy that wrote The Game, who's a pickup artist dude, and he's kind of now transcended that. He's actually coming on the show in a couple of weeks. He said, unspoken expectations are premeditated resentments.
Interesting.
And I think that that's absolutely true. So what you've said, you mentioned about giving yourself language, giving yourself the language to be able to understand and make sense of why might this be the case. Everything that we've spoken about so far, except for, you know, body work, and you can do things in classes, but the unpacking and the unpicking of these stories haven't yet talked about it being in relation to somebody else, about opening up and explaining this story to somebody else. What's the role of sort of communion and conversation and other people here?
It's a tricky issue. Now, therapists always talk about relation. And then my reaction is, it's not really a relationship. A relationship is if I look out for you and you look out for me. But in therapy, it's some way, not entirely, it's a one-way street. As a therapist, I look after you, and you don't have to look after me. I use my reactions to understand you better, but I don't expect you to take care of me or to be considerate of me all that much. And so, yes, I think the interpersonal aspect is terribly important. You need to feel that somebody is on your side, that somebody has your back. And I think relationships become important, and when you're traumatized, oftentimes your relationships become very impoverished. But the relationships you have with real people and not so much with your therapist. Your therapist becomes a role model to some degree, maybe, but most of all, it becomes a deeply accepting sense who helps you to be curious and open about yourself and who gives you the courage to meet yourself, actually. That's what I would say.
There's a lot of criticism and skepticism at the moment about therapy and therapy culture. Abigail Schreier recently wrote a book called Bad Therapy. She went on Joe's show. She came on this show. What do you think therapy looks like when it's at its best?
I see a lot of terrible therapy going also. And, you know, I do a lot of supervision in various countries and places. And I meet therapists all the time who says, how do I manage these patients? And I go, you don't manage other people. I can barely manage myself. I cannot manage other people at the same time. But I can help you to feel yourself, to understand yourself, and to really go deep inside. And I have some tricks in my book of a variety of different techniques that will help you to go deeper into yourself. But in order to do so, you have to become subject of that yourself. So you have to go through it yourself and really have deeply explored your own mind, your own history, your own psyche. I can proudly say in my book, I experience every technique I write about, and I know what it did for me. Some of them were more helpful than others. But it's very important for a therapist to become the subject of therapy themselves. And that's no longer a requirement.
In psychiatry, is that right?
Yeah. In psychiatry, people are not at all expected to do their own therapy.
How interesting.
Or the drugs that they give to people. Now, I almost got fired from my medical school because I used to tell my residents, you know, when you give these drugs to people, you should take it yourself to see what it does to your mind. And the dean said, one more comment like that, the usual faculty appointment.
Francis Galton, who was the man that invented eugenics back in the 1900s, early 1900s, such a fascinating, absolutely fascinating guy. He submitted a patent for how to cut a birthday cake so that you don't ever get it to go hard. So rather than cutting it in slices, you cut a bit down the middle and then you push the two outer parts together. His sister was born with a spinal condition, so she laid on a table while he spoke to her, and he educated her through speaking to her. He was a very quirky guy. He's very worth looking into his history. But one of the things that he did was he went through the list of pharmacology treatments and medicines alphabetically, and I think he got to C. And then when he got to C, he took something, I can't remember the name of it. It's like catswood or something. He took something that caused him to shit himself so badly that 5 decades later, when he wrote his autobiography, he still had memory of like this violent diarrhea.
Yeah.
I love that story.
I'm doing a thing on William James right now. The Fellow of American Psychology, and he tried it all himself also. And he did some weird things with himself.
The things that we do for science.
No, but we should. You know, I don't think you can be a detached scientist. You still make selections of what's important, what's unimportant, and still your emotional brain labels what's important, what's unimportant.
Mm. You know? Okay, so we're talking about therapy being one of those things which, when done well, can be fantastic. When done badly, and sometimes is done badly, doesn't necessarily help. I think one of the questions I had coming in was how much of the modalities that you're suggesting are dealing with symptoms or able to unpick deeper responses. And it seems to me like they, most of the effective ones do both, that they create a state in which you can then move a little step deeper and I can still feel safe and this is okay. And let's have a look at this story. What's the emotion that's coming up? And then that's okay. So we move one step deeper. Okay. What's the story? Why might this be the case? I can use a little bit of executive functioning without ripping myself out of the emotion, but I can still use, bring a little bit of the front brain in and start to see this for what it is. Okay. What might be a good way for me to continue? How can I stress test this? How is this true? And that seems like a good model to me. It seems like a nice balance of control and of ease. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. So, you know, it is not the culture we live in. The culture we live in is, that people adhere to a particular treatment. Let's say you're a Freudian psychiatrist and that becomes your answer to everything. And you see that oftentimes in therapy, I see that many of my colleagues who are about my age, who have studied the same treatment their entire lives. And they found their data 30 years ago, but they're still doing the same stuff. Instead of saying, now let's see what else works and what worked for the people who didn't work for, they keep doing the same thing. And a lot of therapists tend to be like that. They find one little thing and they continue with the same thing. But my program has always been very much about is, we learn a lot of different things. And so therapists tend not to evaluate on a regular basis, something I'm very much promoting these days, to on a regular basis see, so how far have we come? What has been accomplished? And what hasn't been accomplished? And what do we know can help with that? Let's say if you are chronically anxious or frazzled, despite the fact you've done a lot of stuff, how do we deal with that? Does a yoga practice help for that? Let's see. Maybe a neurofeedback practice helps to calm that brain down by changing the rewiring of your brain. It's very important, and that's not happening right now in any program that I know of, where people learn about multiple options and learn about what options are best under what particular circumstances.
You mentioned that you tried every modality that you put in The Body Keeps the Score. Yeah. Which is the one that you have found to be either most impactful or the one that you keep coming back to most regularly?
I come back to basically all of them. My favorite clinical activity is psychodrama, where you can have a virtual three-dimensional experience of how things could have been different back then. So that's my clinical practice. What was most helpful for me, I think, of all things I've done, was Rolfing. I was born in 1943 under conditions pretty similar to what the kids in Ukraine are experiencing right now. And that became imprinted on me. I was a very sickly child, like many people of my generation at the end of the war. A lot of kids died. And I was a sickly kid, and I was sort of living in a semi-sickly body. And what was extraordinarily helpful for me was getting Rolfed. Rolfing is a very intense form of body work where my body was sort of rearranged to be more flexible and not be stuck in that frightened little kid part that was part of me. It had nothing to do with cognition. It is just my body was freed up to respond differently to the world. So it's very different from how I was trained with Freudian psychoanalysis, basically.
Yes.
And that was all she wrote, ladies and gentlemen. That was all she wrote. I'll see you again tomorrow. Same time, same place. And we're diving.